Well, good morning and welcome to the February 3rd, 2020 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Commission. Today's meeting is both a business and a study session. Starting this morning at 10 is the business session with the with the business session starting today at 1. We welcome public input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you do wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you please come to the microphone at the desk adjacent to me. Please state your name, your address for the record, and also, if you'd be kind enough, limit your comments to 3 minutes so that others would have an opportunity. Today we have four commissioners present, and Commissioner Ann Congdon is joining us by phone. General Manager Steve Wright is here. We have Katie Yaunt with us, representing legal counsel, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, along with Steve Wright, General Manager. So today we have a Pledge of Allegiance along with a Safety Minute, and that will be presented by Scott Hansen. Scott, thank you.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
I was asked to...
Scott, would you mind grabbing the microphone when you have a minute? Just to... Thank you, since it is recorded.
I was asked to come in and do an HPI minute for everybody. At Central Maintenance, something we've been working on is procedures so that... things are done consistently every time, and reduce the amount of errors and increase our quality and efficiency. So I'd like to hand these out to y'all real quick.
Sure. Thank you. And we'll lay one on your desk for you. Thank you very much. Can I have a second? Let me give it to Ann. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And what we've put together so far is a book of disassembly procedures for completely disassembling the small units at Rocky Reach. We're almost completed with the reassembly version as we just finished C1. And so that will be coming out here in the near future. In our procedures, like in the primary considerations, it goes through things to look at and think of and take care of in advance and what you're going to need to do after this procedure has been completed to help us prevent errors in those steps. As we go down into the job requirements, it lists the crafts that we're going to need so we have the right staff, the qualifications and certifications that they might need, you know, specialty skills, again, to prevent errors and keep us on track. Tool lists that of the normal things that aren't in our normal toolbox so that we can maintain the focus of the task at hand rather than looking for a tool or finding a tool and it's broken. This allows us to prep the job in advance and make sure that we're ready to do the work and we can stay focused on the tasks at hand. We go down to 5.0 is the actual procedure that will list out step by step in chronological order of the process of doing that task in that procedure. Errors are recurring, so if we do our work in a repetitive manner and everybody's doing it the same, everybody's on the same page, so we can kind of prevent some things from happening and not even know that they were going to happen. In the body of the procedure, there are notes and warnings, critical steps. In 5.1, step number 8, there is a point where we have to remove a handrail in order to get the components of the turbine shaft support stand in place. And we have signs that we place so that anybody entering already knows that that's there. These warnings and signs are all defenses that we use to stay on the safest side of the work that we can. There's a lot of hazards. We just try and eliminate the hazard and carry on. The torque values are listed so that we don't have to stop our work and go find a torque chart, and it's all in order for us to use, whether we're using a lubricant or a Loctite or an anti-seize, and which one specifically that the engineers require is also included in here. Again, so that, you know, the guys can stay focused on the task at hand, what they're doing, and move forward. And it not only makes it safer, but the quality of our work keeps moving up. And so does the quantity of work. And that's kind of the overall of these procedures that we're trying to do, is make it safer, better, and get more of it accomplished in the same time frame. In these documents, you know, the foreman can print this out. We've got the technical library is starting a page on SharePoint. And once these are completed and approved, they're being put on there so that the foreman can get to them and print them. At Central Maintenance, we have about half of our workforce has been there less than 5 years, with all of our new apprentices and retirements and everything. And this allows them the opportunity to see what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and how we're going to stay safe. So the documents have come a long way, and they're very helpful. They're a living document. Each time we use it, we go back and examine our practices to see how we can do it better and safer. So all the guys on the crew just make notes on here, and we go back in and adjust these documents. Wes Rush and Tony Nelson have been very supportive. This takes a lot of work and a lot of time, and we couldn't do it without everybody being involved. And that's about all I really have for you. This is what we're doing. The documents at the bottom left of the page tells you the version and the revision number of it, when it was done, so that you know that if you have the most current edition, this is a draft. The approved procedures have the watermark on them, approved. And the SharePoint will have the most recent version. We're trying to eliminate all of the old documents that are out there that aren't quite up to date. Equipment has changed, and so have our practices and the rules that we have to follow. So that's what we've been doing at Central Maintenance, and there's a lot here that's very useful. And you're welcome to visit SharePoint and look at them. And any recommendations we take from anybody, so we can look at them, and the whole goal is to make it better. I think that's about all I had to share.
I think we've got commissioners that want to comment here.
this is absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's not only is it about safety, but it's you're capturing knowledge in the process that as a workforce changes over years, capturing this knowledge and the SharePoint is, and then continuously updating it, I'm impressed. It's just valuable. But I have to ask a question. What kind of a tool does it take to torque the 3,200 foot-pounds?
We're very fortunate at the district that we have a lot of nice equipment. The torque values are very important on a lot of the things that we do, and we have a couple of different ways of doing it. We have a rad gun. It's a pneumatic tool that resembles a rattle gun, but they are calibrated, and you adjust the air pressure, and it has a reaction arm and a gearbox built into it. So at 3,200 foot-pounds of torque, you dial it into 41 PSI, and when it quits turning, you're done.
It's got to be a pretty big tool.
It's heavy. We also have hydraulic torque wrenches that of a variety of sizes. They're only good through certain ranges, so we have multiple sizes of the rad guns and the high torques. And thank you all for letting us have those tools, because the old-fashioned way was a lot harder.
Yeah.
I can imagine. We'll have the C2 turbine coming out within probably 8 weeks or so, and it would be nice to see you all come out and see what the insides of a turbine really look like. So we'd be happy to have you.
Sounds like an invitation.
Yeah, really.
I've enjoyed stopping by and seeing that a couple times. And Scott, it's really impressive. You know, it reminds me of watching an airplane pilot go through with, you know, the co-pilots, their team, getting ready to take off for flight and making sure that everything's safe, and training new employees and apprentices. And I think the other thing that's really telling here is that you create, with HPI and providing this kind of detail, it really demonstrates pride in your work. And, you know, it feels good to go to work when you're doing something that's important and it's long-lasting and it's going to go way beyond your time here. And I just want to commend you for that. That I can hear that in your voice, I can see it in your face, and I can see it in your work. And I just want to thank you for taking that pride and enjoying and sharing that pride too. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Scott, in several places in here it talks about chain fall. Now my mind can conjure up all kinds of things to define chain fall. Can you tell me specifically from your perspective what chain fall is?
It's a mechanical device that we use for lifting and pulling and moving heavy items, and again, they're in a variety of ranges for their load, half ton to 10 ton. Of course, their size grows with their limit, and we do a lot of hand rigging. When we start to disassemble a unit, a lot of it is done with hand rigging.
Okay.
Until such point we can get the unit open to where the crane has access. And in this particular one, there is a lot of creative work to be done. You only have certain places that you can hook one up. And whatever you're hooking it to has to be rated for as much as it's good for, or you're going to pull something down. And so it requires everybody on the team to be paying attention and watching what we're doing and how it's done. And We use chain falls and lever hoists.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Scott, I need to chime in and tell you that this is most impressive, what you're doing, and the time that it takes, and I'm certain it takes a lot of time to pull all this together and get it accurate, but it's time very well spent. So I appreciate that you take the time I appreciate that you have the pride in what you do. I think it's critically important that not only do we document it so that we have a routine, but others in the future can follow that routine. So it's a knowledge transfer, which is critically important to the organization. So I want to say thank you. And I want to also point out that this takes safety one level higher, that if everyone's on the same page, everyone has read this, you're less likely to have a problem or a misunderstanding. And I think that that is, again, critical for this organization. So thank you for taking the time to create the document. Thank you for taking the time to search on the database to eliminate those that are outdated and replace them with the new. It's very impressive. So thank you.
Thank you. And it's actually a very big effort. If Wes and Tony weren't there to support it and allow the time, because it does take time, for us to do that. And Chad Dulac is one of our tech writers that I put out a draft, and he makes it magic. He makes it come to life. You know, it's not just me. It's a team effort. There's a lot of people involved.
So please take the message back to your team. Let them know how much this commission appreciates what you're doing.
I'll do that.
Thank you, Scott.
You bet.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And it's good to see somebody come and present with Carhartt, wearing Carhartt. Thank you. It adds credibility.
Well, I got to get back to work. Thank you for your time.
Uh-huh. Right. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, well, commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Do I hear any requests?
I'd like to suggest that resolution number 15 be moved to the consent agenda as has been recommended.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The ayes have it. Steve, would you like to take over and...
Yeah, so we are ready to do the end-of-year report on the district performance plan status. And so we do this in the traditional way that we've been doing it. You have the material in front of you. We'll be reporting on by exception, which means something that has changed from the third quarter to the fourth quarter. Of course, because it's end-of-year, we do have a lot of completions, so this take a little bit longer than other quarters. We will try to go keep moving along, but at the same time at a pace at which you should feel comfortable asking questions. So please, if it feels like we're going too fast and you want to ask a question, just cause us to slow down. We're going to start with Mike Coleman.
Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecom. This is one of those times that I don't like being first. It means that I missed an important objective. We did miss the number of fiber expansion premises passed. We ended the year with 624 actual premises passed versus an objective of 1,033. The primary areas that were affected by that were Steins Hill, Chumstick, and Eagle Creek. We just could not get the make-ready work done in time. Eagle Creek and Steins Hill has been in progress. They're continuing to work on it, and we will have those finished up as soon as possible, weather permitting. Chumstick is a little bit different. We've had to come back in and reevaluate the analysis on the infrastructure. A third party is wrapping that up now, and then work packages will be developed, work plans, and we will develop the milestones for when we will be able to complete Chumstick. We're also still evaluating how much we can handle in 2020, both the carryover from 19 and the projects that were scheduled for 2020, and at the same time looking at the possibility of accelerating the expansion program for the remainder of the program. So we will come back to you in the first quarter with that, end of first quarter.
Would that potentially, if there was an acceleration, would it potentially be with some contract installation?
We're using contractors now where it does make sense, where it conflicts with priorities and given resources. So as we look at it, and particularly look at the question of acceleration, that will be one thing that's on the table, yes.
Mike, I'm assuming that the communication with the people in Eagle Creek, et cetera, has been good, because the people who usually call me when it's not good have not been calling. So I'm guessing that we've been in full communication with them and they understand what's going on.
I can assure you that we've done everything possible in the realm of communications.
Yeah.
On Eagle Creek, we also were able to get the underground portion to where we could light it up by the end of the year. Second thing is, one of the residents out there took it upon himself to be a point of contact for the other residents. Kevin Powers has done a absolutely fantastic job in communicating with the other residents and offering them information, and particularly offering them the fact that not only are they going to get fiber, but as part of it, we're also redoing the electrical infrastructure, so that's a positive for them also. And no, I have been very, very surprised that the number of comments has been almost nothing out of Eagle Creek. We sent out letters to each of those three areas to tell them up front that we weren't going to make it, but we were working on it. And we got very few comments from any of the areas.
Thank you.
That's great.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks.
Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. I've got the next three items. Starting on page 1E, administer the annual public power benefit program with board updates in Q2 and Q4. We did provide you an update on December 16th. The reason that is red is I think we had a target of no later than 12-1, so just missed that by a couple of weeks, but we did provide you that update, that second update for the year. And then on the bottom of the page on 1, decision on BB Bridge Park camping pilot. The camping pilot opportunity has been placed on hold while we evaluate an online reservation system. And so we're still working through the evaluation of options related to that. Another challenge is just competing priorities. The implementation of such a system, particularly the initial review and contractual nature, requires quite a bit of PCS and legal time, and there's of course been a lot of other efforts that we've been engaged in. So do hope to make a decision one way or the other first quarter of this year, and we'll continue to update you.
I do want to note, though, that we have pulled that from the 2020 performance plan as a high priority item. Just with all the other things going on, this is a decision that we felt we needed to make. So we are going to continue to make progress, but we are signaling to PCS and legal that it's not on the highest priority list.
And then on page 2, GH, a decision on future funding of Arondo River Park by 9:30. What we decided to do for 2020 was to have a single-year contract for $30,000, which will allow us the time that we need to continue negotiations. As you're aware, there was a consolidation of the port districts, so we'll work with Chelan Douglas Regional Port Authority this year on a long-term management solution for Arondo River Park, and we will update you on progress.
So you answered a question that I had in my mind on that one, that will be administered by the Port Authority, but my understanding, that's still Douglas Port's property.
Yes, Douglas Port property, and then the district has a smaller piece of property there as well.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Kirk is out today, so I've got the next one. This is the hydro capability. Our goal had been to come in at 72.1%. We came in at 71.5. It was close, but But we have struggled, and we definitely are struggling with particularly the units being out in C1 through 7, 1, 2, and 3, and 7, actually, being the specific units due to the oil releases. Very focused this year, as you heard, as we laid out the district performance plan for 2020 on trying to get that back on track.
Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources. The next two are mine. The first one is the completion of our energy efficiency goals and targets for 2019. Came in on target, so that was complete. The second one is related to converting the program. I think I mentioned to you before, it used to be called conservation, and then it was the term changed to be energy efficiency. And now what companies are discovering is that they need a kind of a energy solutions group for companies. Andrew has developed that. He is prepared to do, but at the end of the year, given the amount of things that were on our plate at the end of the year, Steve and I asked him to push that back to Q1. So Andrew will be coming back to you and describing what the current trend is on customer energy solutions in the near future.
On information, this is on item J under asset management, number one, the asset information turnover and project management. This is one that ultimately was completed, but I will also say that we continue to struggle some with trying to get to turnover of projects. This is the question of when a project is completed, we want to try to create great documentation so that people can come back 10 years, 20 years and understand what went on. And we're definitely challenged with trying to bring units back online and the focus on that, and also doing a great job on turnover. So I just want you to know it has been a struggle for us.
Commissioners, I have the next one. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Under the asset management strategy, this one was to develop a whole life cost modeling tool. And speaking to that, it's helpful for within the distribution business unit. Where it comes into play is when we have assets that require a lot of maintenance. So think of like a substation transformer where we're doing maintenance on a periodic basis. And as that ages, this tool helps to understand, is it time to replace or to continue to maintenance and extend that asset? So, which again is very helpful as we look to the future and understanding our assets as well as our capital needs and our budget.
John, I have a question on that. It seems like manufacturing life expectancies on equipment are a little bit less than what they used to be. And does that compound the difficulty in trying to determine lifespan to do maintenance work on? And at what point do you replace? Or how are you addressing that?
Well, I'll speak to the transformer, and they're probably how they manufacture that. It's probably gone through quite of a evolution over the years. But what's helpful for us with this, we do a condition monitoring, where it's evaluated when they do that maintenance. So it kind of gives us a stoplight report on how it's looking, or kind of a heat map. And again, these hopefully are intended to be, 50-plus year assets, ideally. Depends on the conditions they operate. But that's probably the biggest variable, is not only how you're maintaining them, but what type of a load condition are these put under? Does that age them faster, so to speak? But again, having this tool where you can constantly get a condition assessment and then do that analysis on the life cycle cost, and does it continue maintaining or replace it?
So. Okay, thanks.
Can I ask John a quick question?
Yeah, please.
While it's on my mind, the Cashmere substation, what got changed there? I noticed the lights are different, and did the whole unit get rehabbed?
Are you talking about the one off? Is it River Road, right there by the bridge?
Yeah.
Okay.
Across from the cemetery.
Yeah.
Across from the cemetery.
Oh, from the cemetery.
Pioneer Avenue. Yeah. Pioneer Avenue.
Yeah, that's the one. We call that our mission substation. And they've done quite a bit of extensive work there. Primarily the big ticket was replacing the control house, where a lot of the gauges and the controls sit. It was needed to be replaced. So I haven't seen it since they've got that pretty much buttoned up, but yeah, it probably did change some of the lighting, because it's a new house.
It looks like
I got to drive that route. I haven't seen it. So
thank you.
All right. Good morning. This is Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and number three in the same asset management category. We did complete the pilot project to take the asset management data and feed it into a data warehouse each night, and then that makes all the data available for reporting and dashboarding. So this is improving how we are housing that data for ease of access. And definitely a lot of learning in the pilot project, and this will be an area for continuous improvement.
Okay, I've got the next couple on the middle of page 5 under O, Implement Long Range Facilities Plan. First one is construction of Rock Island, Phase 2, 75% complete by 12-1. We did not hit that 75% complete number, primarily because of the opportunity that we had and presented to you regarding the C-19 building. And so we are a little bit behind the 75% number. We do have a number of items in this year's performance plan related to the facilities plan. So we'll provide you regular updates. C-21 and C-22 will be complete kind of in the July through October timeframe with commissioning and completion. And just a reminder, the C-19 building itself would be done approximately a year from today. Or a year from now. And then under 2, final design, Rocky Reach Phase 1 by 12-1. We were delayed a little bit there. We didn't quite hit the 100% design by 12-1. We hit 90% complete. And so that design has now been complete. We're doing our kind of final costing work. We'll be proceeding with some of the bid work, and then you will see something formally in terms of a presentation in your last meeting in April is what we've targeted.
A comment on both of those, just knowing that we all as a commission toured facilities as a precursor to us entering into all of this, as soon as possible when we're at a completion point, it'd be really great to have another tour. And we invited the press on that tour just to see what we've accomplished and that change that's occurred. I'm excited about what we're doing.
Excellent. Okay, we will definitely look for that, the right timing and the opportunity.
And it might be a year or two out. I understand that. So
just thinking it might be as much as that. We'll have a few more buildings done this summer.
Right.
But probably closing in on completing work, at least at the hydro facilities. Probably be more like 18 months or so, I would think.
Yeah, but that would be really good to showcase, I think.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
I've got the next one, which is Q2. This is the work that's being done. Remember, we did the analysis of where we needed to harden our system for fire risk, and are moving out on Chelan Manson. That project is on track. We also have been conducting public outreach on Sunage Dead Horse Canyon, which is the connection between Plain and Lake Wenatchee. We really have reset the public outreach there to have more of a conversation around fire risk in general. We're talking to the county commission and others about potentially leading that conversation about overall fire risk and how does the transmission line fit within that, coming back to our mission statement. How do we enhance the quality of life in Chelan County? And the focus is broader than just what do we do with the transmission system. So we've had some good conversations, continue to have good conversations. I would say we have not made that full transition yet. We're in the midst of it. We're going to see whether others agree with us that that's the right way to approach it. And that's why we're behind.
Commissioners, I have the next one. We're on page 6 under S. Several things around the substation planning and siting. Number 4 is complete the North Shore substation general arrangement and access plan. We didn't hit that mark this year, primarily due to work associated with the OMI substation that's being currently constructed, as well as supporting the Diamond Foundry substation. Just took our technical resources focused on that. But, however, we anticipate leveraging some of that work, especially around the OMI substation, to have kind of a template to move forward when we move into these other areas, including North Shore as well as the Bavarian. So we have both of those anticipated to be completed in 2020. Number 6 is the complete the public outreach for the South Shore Transmission Line project. We went through that. That was led by Andy and his team with support from transmission, working with the adjacent stakeholders in the city. Identified a route. That route is now being put into a design phase, so then that can have further study from an environmental technical standpoint. But again, that outreach was completed over last year. Moving into T on the capital plans, on schedule and within budget. We didn't think we were going to make it, but we just pulled it over our goal of exceeding 80% of our capital budget throughout our customer utilities business unit. This was really helped push it forward as we had some large water and wastewater capital projects that they were right on 100%. So distribution was around 72%, I believe. But when you total it all up, it met the 80%.
And then right at the bottom of the page on number 6, well, John just made it. We just missed it in our IT projects. But it's one of those mixed results. There's some good news in it in that we did finish some of the projects under budget, like storage, adding new storage capacity, some new network switches, and then replacing our firewalls. So those were all good ones of finishing under budget. But we are lagging in a few of the projects that also contributed to being just under things. One of the primary ones is the dispatch log, and that's an area of focus that will continue into 2020.
Good morning, Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources. I have marked U1 at the top of page 7 complete, and that's for 2019 because this is really an ongoing effort. In fact, I was just talking with Commissioner Smith this morning about some efforts we're going to be making in 2020.
Moving on to objective 3, which is protecting natural resources impacted by our operations. So item A5 is the we track every year the impact on plant species and bull trout that we don't have mortality above the allowable level, which I think is 1. It's a really small number, and we have to calculate that through the end of the year, and we did complete that successfully this year.
Moving down into B, under the complete the Dryden wastewater capital improvements per schedule agreed with ecology. Item 2, we had developed a capital compliance work plan consistent with permit requirements. We thought we were making good progress, but that turned red at the end of the year. And what that pertains to is we were evaluating a property to build a what they call a large on-site systems septic system. But we did the work around looking at the soil conditions and the geology there, and it wasn't suitable to leverage that type of arrangement. So that's caused us to go back and look at other options, which we are currently doing, and that, again, is on the performance plan for this year. We'll have more information on that.
Up in Dryden?
Yes. And down to G, at the bottom of page 9, we had execute the Peshaston wastewater capital improvement. So this is one, again, where we had a fairly large capital budget. We met that 95% of completion of that project. So by year end, we were into the phase of just doing punch list items and final closeout.
Greg Carrington again. There's 2 items on here that we have pushed back. We're in the process of completely revising our risk management policies associated with trading. So before we got into a long a plan associated with the portfolio of retail wholesale, we were completing the wholesale risk management policies. We'll be prepared in Q1, Q2 to be able to come back in here and take a look at what the portfolio should look like in the future. So the first one is kind of that wholesale retail mix, where we're working on that currently, and the second one is looking at how the risk would be affected by the different portfolios as well. Any questions about that?
And I just want to say the reason for the review of the policy is we've talked here before about resource adequacy and how things are changing in the market, and so we're changing our risk appetite basically to reflect that. And you'll be seeing
this is a big one.
Yeah, you'll see this relatively soon.
Yep.
Greg, are you using any kind of a computer program to help plot risk?
Yeah, Craig
Koontz is helping us a lot. I developed what I call an unsophisticated spreadsheet model on my own, and then realized quickly that it's better to take a look at a long range type. I kind of looked at a snapshot in the analysis that I did and realized that we need to take a look at, as our portfolio changes over time, how does that affect us 5 years out? How does it affect us 10 years out? And looking at the long range. So we actually had a meeting this morning. We know all of the different portfolios we want to take a look at, and we'll be able to come back eventually and say, here's what we're doing. Here's, you know, what the impact will be to our bottom line, and we can make decisions in the future based on that model. So, yes, there is a fairly sophisticated model that we've developed.
So just as long as your spreadsheet isn't a napkin spread out.
Yeah, well, it's almost like that. Yeah, I needed to get somebody a lot smarter than me to go in there and put the numbers down and look at it longer term for sure.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks.
I've got the next couple, and continue to be frustrated to report to you that the Columbia River Treaty negotiations are not moving forward in a way that we feel comfortable with. I marked the first one as read, that the negotiations are consistent with the regional recommendation, despite the fact the State Department says that they are. It's a very opaque process. It's hard for us to tell for sure, but we have a lot of reservations about whether, in fact, it will end up being consistent with the regional recommendation, particularly the parts about substantial benefit to ratepayers. We see very limited engagement of the power group and the mid-seas with the negotiating team, not consistent with what our expectations were before these negotiations started, and so that one was marked as red as well.
Those two targets used to be mine, and I was so glad when Steve took them over. Trying to predict what
didn't
the
change state anything.
So the next two are mine. The first one has to do with meeting our wholesale revenue targets, and that has been completed. We have met those targets, and to stay within our hedge limits, that has been completed as well.
And then item J, maintaining our AA bond ratings. This was a year of pride again, marked by the affirmation of Fitch of our AA plus rating. But it's just complete here at the end of Q4 because it's not a one-time thing that we do. We keep a relationship all during the year with the rating agencies and provide them information to keep them up to speed and familiar with us. So we did complete our relationship building at the end of Q4, and that's what you see there. And then the next one is item L, which is refining and executing our business planning cycle. So we completed all those tasks, with Q4 being a big quarter of completing all of the items around the five-year business planning, and it culminates in December with the first board meeting in December with the approval of the budget for 2020. So all those items were successfully completed on schedule.
So Kelly, I don't think I've ever asked this question before. But Moody's AA3, how does that compare to the AA plus on the other two?
So it is two notches below, and it is a area where we feel very motivated to help convince Moody's that we deserve an upgrade in that area. But they just have a different philosophy around our business model and the risk associated with the amount of our surplus sales. So we continue to work hard to convince them that we have earned that higher credit. And so you will see our efforts continue in this year to do that. And I think the business planning efforts that the board took on and the recommendations that are coming out of strategic planning are steps in the right direction that will be viewed very favorably and help us continue to make our strong case.
Thank you.
But yes, it is a challenge for us.
I'm glad I asked the question.
It's kind of salt in the wound for me.
What?
The next six are mine. The five out of the six are associated with independent operations and the implementation and completion of that project. The one thing I did want to emphasize is the significance of that. Ryan, you know, was recognized at the last commission meeting. And replacing your energy management system, replacing your accounting system, replacing your real-time dispatch was a very, very significant, even though it seems minor on this piece of paper, a very significant effort went into that and completion of that. And then finally, the last thing is to develop a large retail customer development plan. This had to do a lot with the strategic planning. You might recall that under strategic planning, there were two things that came out of that. One was to develop a liaison person within the district, and that has been implemented, or I guess the job description is in the process of being filled at this time, and that's going to be a person that will be residing within John Stoll's group. And then the other one is develop and explore industrial hubs and where we would place those, and that'll be part of that portfolio analysis as well. So if we decide that a certain percentage of our portfolio is going to be dedicated to retail load, then you go and say, okay, if that's going to be the case, where exactly would an entity coming into Chelan County, where would they go, and making that recommendation. Any questions about anything?
Okay, I've got the next couple under objective number 5, make continuous improvement in efficient, effective, compliant, and risk-assessed operations. I'm down on 5I, standardized district-wide project management processes and templates. The bulk of that work has now been completed, and we've provided that training. We had a target date of that training of 12-1. We actually completed it on 12-5, 12-6, and 12-10. The only remaining item is just to finalize the full implementation of that, which means updating our intranet and other internal resources. And so just working with IT to have that accomplished, and should be there soon. And, of course, this is just part of the wider effort of ensuring that we're efficient and effective as we try to really hit those targets relative to capital spend and go forward with our project list this year.
And then right at the bottom of that same page, item J, advancing our data analytics and business intelligence capabilities. We did successfully complete just over 90% of our roadmap milestones for our business intelligence. And this is actually a really exciting area where we're starting to utilize the data. We have use cases where we're applying the information that we're gathering and trying to glean information ahead of time to recognize things. So we have a couple different modeling efforts, pilot projects in place. We're utilizing some of the information that we're getting from the Hydropower Research Institute and putting it into place, as well as expanding those abilities beyond just the hydro areas. And a lot of it really has to do with getting your data in order. So we've been working a lot in really advancing in that area. So stay tuned in this area. I think you'll be hearing a lot more as we continue to get better and better.
So Kelly, do we have somebody, an applied mathematics specialist that helps with that, or does that fall into your area? Or?
It's a team effort as far as the overall knowledge. There's a lot of expertise in those pockets, but we do have a business analytics area or department within finance, and we do have we supplement that with using, you know, kind of the data scientists. We usually use a contractor to help us supplement that area, but we have a couple really talented people, and one of them is even a statistical master's degree in statistics, and it really advances our abilities in that to be able to apply that to what we see. So his modeling talents are really helpful in this area to advance our abilities. But we do supplement with using consulting experts where we need them.
Just the short term I've been here, that seems to continue to grow and grow, and so I just was curious personnel-wise.
I think we will continue to grow in our capabilities and probably in in-house experts in this area, as where you need your experts kind of transitions around within an organization. So I do think you will see growth in this area. It's a really important one.
continuing on objective five, we'd go over to item M, which was developing transmission interconnection processes and rates that would be consistent with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission open access transmission tariff. We did not complete that. It shows as yellow because this was a stretch item. Stretch items we don't mark as red, but we didn't make it for this year. And you may recall that we've made this a high priority item for the 2020 plan. We now have a second request for transmission service. We're not sure how far they're going to go with it. It's just at the very, very preliminary stage. But there are definitely some resources out there that are getting developed that are looking for access to our transmission system, so we're getting ourselves prepared for that. Got a couple other items that were completed in item N. Number one, first of all, we have been very active in submitting comments to NERC towards retirement of reliability compliance standards. Again, we're trying to reduce the number. There has actually been action taken now by NERC to retire some more than 70 of the existing standards, which will help us reduce the workload in the compliance work that we do. A very important target for us this year is that by June, I believe it is, of this year, we have to be in compliance with new SIP standards, cybersecurity standards for low-impact assets. And we are on track for that. Very pleased with the fact that LPPC has been very helpful in terms of creating work groups so that utilities can work together to understand these new standards. And there's a lot of new stuff for everybody, so we're trying to work together to make sure that we're not all reinventing the wheel. But making good progress on that, we are on track to have those to be in compliance with the standard when it goes into effect this year.
Top page 15, under maintain and update utility service policies, I have a couple. The first one is the annual fees and charges update that you recall is part of the budget process that was completed this year. Item three, that's consider rate policy and regulation changes due to changing circumstances. We had a pretty significant one this year, and that was the opt-out policy. We had hoped to have that buttoned up by year-end, but it slid into early January, but that's been completed.
I have the next item, which was executing the district telecommunications systems improvement plan. Item two, the implementing of the land mobile replacement, the trunk radio system, that was completed. Item three, on the project closeout, we missed that by a little bit, pending the acceptance of the as-built, but it was completed by the end of the year. Item four, the microwave system replacement capital project, was to be closed out by 10:30. We delayed that. Deliberately delayed it because we negotiated an agreement with Nokia to upgrade a switch router to improve the cyber security functions, and that required us to carry funding into 2020, so that project is being completed first quarter of 2020.
And the next one down under S, advanced intelligent grid capabilities. The first one was developing the roadmap associated with the AMI, and of note is the outage management approach. So due to the CIS consuming a lot of time earlier in the year, we were starting to drift, but then we gained some traction near year-end and were able to submit that. And then similar, selecting the technology, we were able to conclude that by year-end with the selection of the ITRON package with the Silver Springs network.
Item T is we begin to talk about cybersecurity, and I would just say that we completed our objectives for this year. We'll be doing a separate briefing and executive session for the board on cybersecurity issues.
And I have the next item under the cybersecurity, and that was for the fiber and telecom operations, our C2M2 targets that were identified for 2019, and we did complete all of those.
And this is the last update you'll hear from me also on cybersecurity for the business systems, where we also completed our milestones we had for this year for the business systems of continuing our cybersecurity efforts, which is a never-ending task.
And for Now on the top of page 17 under A, this is about delivering two modules for a supervisor academy. We were successful in this partly because Steve graciously offered several sessions on leadership through the power of public service, and those have been quite well received and got lots of interest. The next one that is complete was developing a report for managers on how employees are progressing toward completing their individual development plans, and we did that throughout the year, so that was helpful for them. And then we built on last year's efforts to improve new employee orientation, make it more relevant and more compelling and also a little more interesting for them. So we hope that's made it more interesting.
Morning, Commissioners. Tim Pettit, Director of Safety and Human Performance. Under D here, 7D, complete the review and modifications to the Yellow and Blue Book lockout tagout program. Although that sounds very simple, they're very complex. We did get through the Blue Book, which is our distribution and transmission energy isolation program. We got that complete, training complete, and it's in place. The Yellow Book is our generation energy isolation. Very complex. That book has been here for years and years and years, so when you dig into that to try to create changes, people start looking, and rightfully so. And that's one of the reasons it's red. Elle and I had been in and identified some areas that we definitely needed improvement in. And then ESCI, David Wallace works for ESCI, and he was actually the writer of the energy isolation back in, I believe, 1977. And so he has partnered with us through this journey. We were hoping that it wouldn't be quite as in-depth as it is, but being it got very in-depth, we included a very large group with representatives from multiple groups that touch this Yellow Book, which we felt was critical so that when it's complete, we are all in agreement and on the same page. We are actually hoping that by the end of the first week of March, which is about 5 weeks away, that all the training will be complete, the book will be printed, and everything should be done. Been a lot of work put into that, but it's going to be well worth it. It touches a lot of people. There will be over 300 people to train once those changes are complete. So,
I want to say this is a significant safety enhancement. It just turned out to be a bigger job than we thought it was going to be when we started, but Tim's done a great job, and we're getting pretty close to being finished with this one.
That's good. Thanks.
So with that, we had over 180 items that we were tracking this year, came in at just under 70% that we completed or were on track to meet the performance standard that was established at the beginning of the year. If you take into account the ones that we completed after the deadline, it would be just over 70%. That's where we stand. Any questions or thoughts?
Commissioners, questions?
Well, I do have one comment. There should be one final category that isn't in here, and it should be labeled blue and very good, and that is that this time when we got our packet, all the names were highlighted in yellow, and they were really easy to follow, and I want to thank Rebecca for catching that glitch, fixing whatever it took to fix. Mm-hmm. That helped a lot.
Well, and I'd like to just make a comment about how much effort and work goes into not just generating the report, but all the work behind the report. You know, some might look at this and say, well, you know, 69 or 70%. But when you consider the volume of work and the volume of effort it takes, this is incredible. And it's an incredible journey that we're taking as a district. And really appreciate all the hard work that's going into the work behind this report. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. All right. If we're ready, we'll move on to agenda item 4, quarterly financial review and investment report.
Mark Mullins and Craig Kuntz will be presenting for us.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mark Mullins, Director, Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And to my right,
Craig Kuntz, Manager of Strategic Financial Planning.
So today we'll be presenting our year-end 2019 financial results. These results are preliminary, pending annual audit. There could be, just for our normal year-end reconciliation and processes that we go through, could be a few minor adjustments, but I don't think it'll impact the context of the presentation today. Just some of the formalities. This presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the Board on compliance with our long-range financial policies, business line financial policies, and our investment policy, as well as our Board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. So we'll cover our financial highlights for 2019, year-end results, historical review, which we've done at the end of the year typically, just to provide some perspective. We'll look at our five-year forecast going forward, our investment report, and we'll leave you with some key messages. This is an update only, no action required. There's a lot of details in the appendix, but we won't cover that today. So our highlights for 2019, our bottom line results are better than budget by $36 million. Our bottom line was $114 million. This is consistent with what we provided in Q3. We have higher power contract revenues and lower costs. And those are offsetting the impacts of lower stream flows and unit outages that we have. I will highlight that we do have some unique and infrequent activity in 2019 around our insurance claim settlement, surplus proceeds that we retained, and an actuarial reduction in our pension expense, which is new for December, that are significantly contributing to our bottom line. So absent those three items, we would be very close to budget.
How big was that actuarial change in December?
It was $7 million. So the investment performance was a little bit stronger than anticipated, and there are some actuarial assumptions that go into that as well, and those turned out to be lower than what our contributions were for 2019. So you'll also see in the presentation our capital expenditures were lower than expectations that we budgeted for. We're rolling costs. There's a lot of work going on, rolling some of those costs into future periods, so you'll see that in our long-term forecast. Our financial metrics are meeting our targets, and our long-term capital plans are fully utilizing our positive results that we've seen. We are recommending we stay the course with the new 2020 through 2024 strategic goals and continue moving forward. So looking at our income statement on the revenue side, service revenue is better than budget by $10 million, primarily due to the Microsoft off-system end-use sale of about $13 million, and that's offset by the lower than expected HDL and crypto impacts. On the net wholesale revenue side of things, those megawatt hours that we sold to Microsoft were originally budgeted for in this category. So you're seeing an offset there. That is below budget, $27 million for the year, primarily due, besides the Microsoft, but also lower generation at 83% of expectations due to the lower stream flow conditions and unit outages. On the hydro long-term contract revenue, we are better than budget for the year by $6 million. As mentioned earlier, we did have $20 million in retained surplus proceeds, but that was offset by a reduction in our hydro production costs associated with the insurance claim settlement and our expenditures and O&M were slightly lagging. Other operating revenue better than budget by $19 million. Primarily due to the insurance claim settlement proceeds recorded in this category and also the variable component of our real-time agreement where we saw some benefits over expectations from when we originally budgeted that. So total revenues for the year, $8.5 million better than budget, fairly consistent with our Q3 forecast. On the operating expenses, we are better than budget by $23.5 million, a lot less spending at the hydros. But we also have our insurance claim settlement proceeds for those current year expenditures that were offset. And then we have the actuarial reduction of our pension expense. And just as a reminder, it's not a change to our program. It's just the actuarial adjustment of $7 million that's contributing to that variance. On the non-operating net expense is better than budget by $4 million, primarily due to the benefits of having higher cash balances. So our interest earnings are a little bit higher. Overall, Total net expenses, $27.6 million, better than budget. The primary difference from our Q3 forecast is that pension expense adjustment recorded in December. So overall, bottom line, ending the year at $114 million, better than budget by $36 million. Of course, that magic formula of higher revenues and lower expenses for the year. Moving over to the capital side, as mentioned earlier, we are significantly lagging in our capital spend. We had a budget of $152 million. We ended up the year at $83 million, or about 50% of our total 2019 budget. A lot of things that have happened throughout the course of the year. Of course, our Rock Island projects are shifting significantly. So those projects with Powerhouse 1, the Rock Island facilities, but also our soon-to-be Powerhouse 2 modernization, a lot of those costs are getting shifted forward. So it's not that we're not going to incur the expenses. It's just a matter of we're not doing it this year. So a lot of those things had moved forward. On the cash side of things, we did build cash by $24 million versus our 2018 year-end balance, ending the year at $615 million. As compared to our forecast at $594, the primary difference is just the adjustment in our capital spend expectations where we ended up the year. On the debt side, we ended the year at a debt balance of $473 million. This includes a $40 million reduction in net principal payments, so a significant accomplishment there as well. And unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Craig, and he can get into some of the more details.
Thank you, Mark. Mark did a great job. He hit the main talking points during that overview, so I'm just going to this kind of brings it all together in one picture, and I think the items I'll just point out here are consistent with what he said. You can see the operating revenue, significant increase here. Again, that has to do with the insurance settlement on the claims. And you can see the operating expenses being below budget, two things primarily, again, the insurance claims and the pension expense adjustment. And then the non-operating activity, that's actually a net expense. That's better than what we expected, again, for the interest earnings from the cash balances. So very consistent, good talking points before. Looking at the business line, bottom line results, you can really see that, you know, those $37 million of the unique and infrequent activity is really reflected in Integrated Electric. The surplus proceeds, the settlement, and the pension expense adjustment primarily float through the Integrated Electric. And you can see without the $37 million, we'd be pretty much right in budget, line expectations. As far as fiber, water, and wastewater, one item of note, why these are so, waters off. In regards to the Horan land purchase, that was a capital purchase. Each of the systems share their costs. It's really unique. Normally, we share those costs and create rent schedules to pay back. Since it's land, it's not a depreciable asset. So we pretty much had to take, for accounting purposes, we took it as basically an expense. So if we were to sell this property in the future, the gain from that would go back through as a positive bottom line. So just to put in context, if that activity wasn't accounted for that way, which is the proper accounting, water would have been at 90% of budget, and wastewater would have been at 100% of budget. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take much to move that, and it's not big dollars, but when you account for it that way, it's the way we account. You know, it's just unique of a land asset. It's a shared asset versus a capital depreciable asset. Just wanted to highlight that. Looking at capital expenditures, Mark touched on Rock Island for the most part. I'll just hit a couple more. Consistent with the balance score update, electric distribution lagging a little bit, primarily due to some substation work. You mentioned OMI, Bavarian, and North Shore. You know, it's planned to get completed in 2020. Just got kicked out there. Number two, Rocky Reach. Again, there was a BB Park work and some Rocky Reach Hackery work that was deferred to 2020, consistent with messaging in Q3. I like to look at internal services and Rock Island together because part of the internal services is the work up at CM, that facility's work, and coordinated with the Rock Island, all those major capital projects and the timing and changes we've had there, consistent communication. Fiber and telecom, one thing that was brought up, you might have caught, was there was $1 million capital budget, which was the portal. That got reclassified as an O&M expense, so that's a main driver of that reduction as far as expectations. And then I'm just going to highlight this coming up this later is there's a resolution in regards to regulatory accounting, which is pending board approval. But these figures actually for network transmission reflect what that action would be. So there was some capital activity that there's going to be a board resolution to go to regulatory accounting.
All that's doing is moving that to a different type of asset than a capital asset. And that's what this is reflecting. Now, if we didn't, it would go back to this expenditure type. Again, it's a regulatory asset. It will be amortized similar to a capital asset. It would be depreciated. It's just the classification. It's no longer going to be a capital expenditure. So I took the privilege of showing you that information beforehand. And that's the main reconciling difference between budget and actuals on that. So looking at our 2019 cash flow, again, bottom line results, $114 million. We add back our non-cash related items, primarily depreciation. We get to $158 million, basically our funds from operation. We spent gross $83 million on capital. We had a net debt reduction of $40 million. We had other changes to our accounts receivable, kind of the non, you know, accounts payable, AR. So we added $24 million to our cash reserves. So at the end of the year, at the beginning of the year, we had $591 million. We added 24, and we're at $615 million at year end. Breaking down our cash and investment balances a little further compared to last year, I think this is always a good refresher of kind of what happened here, particularly when we look at our unrestricted funds. So if you look at the year end balance in 2018, we were at 407, and now we're at 363. Always like to remind everyone that we did do an internal loan to our hydros, to Rock Island, for their capital investments from unrestricted, which goes down to this restricted funds for capital here, $87 million. So if you look at our total liquidity, it's actually up, pretty much consistent with our cash increase of 24. It's really just a classification between those two funds, an unrestricted to kind of a what we consider our DRC, CRC capital investment funds. Those are restricted for use for capital expenditures, but they're treated as liquidity. Secondary liquidity, so our liquidity wasn't impacted by that transfer, just the unrestricted cash. And again, I would note, in, as part of a board-designated funds, we still have the $50 million for the headquarters and service center facilities funds as we move forward. Again, $591 to $615 million in cash. Now, this is a historical side of our operation, maintenance, and plant additions, and it's intended to show, you know, our slow trend of increase in costs and expenditures. And what's unique here, and I just want to highlight it, if you look at 2018 to 2019, particularly on the operation and maintenance expense, this is where those unique and infrequent activity really is not showing that trend because they're reducing our expenses. I mean, they incur, but the pension expense adjustment and those insurance proceeds adjustment offsets. So the trend is higher, but this is what it is when you have those unique and infrequent things. And just to put this in context, if we were at 100% of budget for both capital and operation and maintenance, this would be a $92 million higher than what we're reflecting here, both through operation and maintenance and capital, without those, you know, unique activities. And those capital plans, like we said, they're rolling into the future years, so that money is already being planned to be spent into the future. And this is kind of looking how we've leveraged our good financial results for both our growing our cash reserves and paying down our debt. Going back to 2013, we've gone from $816 million to $473 in debt, and our cash balance has actually gone up nearly $200 million. Again, I like to just say that, you know, and you'll see in the future, and it's a consistent message we've said, that trend on cash is looking to, you know, reverse as we continue to invest in capital assets. Our debt, we're not looking at doing anything until 2022. We may borrow. We've reached all of our debt leverage ratio targets a year ahead of schedule. So this is kind of going right right according to plan, just laying the groundwork as far as, you know, we're looking to utilize all this cash in the future. Consistent message, what we said.
Won't there be a little bit of debt reduction just based on normal
Continue to do our normal debt reduction as scheduled. We're not planning any accelerated debt, but we are thinking about the, you know, we talked about during the budget process, the plan of finance. We may do some restructuring of debt. Accordingly, we think we can take advantage of the rates favorable for the district. But right here, as this slide shows, we are planning to borrow out in 2022 to maintain liquidity and days cash on hand targets. So, but again, we always assume up to that point we're fully expending all of our capital expenditures coming out of cash. We're cash funding everything, and that's. You just led right into my key four messaging points in regards to the total district combined policy. So the district continues to meet all of its financial policy metrics over the 5 years. However, we do fully utilize our cash reserves above policy requirements, and so that's where we're looking at this time frame for borrowing. still a consistent time frame we've had in 2020, you know, previous quarter presentations. But I would note that this also does assume, and this will lead to a later talking point, that this does assume the current rate actions that are being proposed, effective 1/1/21, those rate increases, 4% for water, wastewater, and 3% for fiber and electric. Those are reflective in here. So when we look at that, that's from a district's financial policies perspective, and then we look at our underlying business line policies. And these are based on the 2015-2019 strategic targets, since we're trying to wrap up that time frame before we go into the 2024 time frame and new policy metrics. Through the strategic planning, you know, we've talked about how the approaches, both water, all water, wastewater, and fiber should be moving towards a more safe, self-sustaining philosophy, which these targets, as we develop the policies and metrics that Lindsay Mons has been presenting in regards to these are the expectations of what we're going to do, all these metrics will change, and we'll start presenting the new metrics consistent with the strategic plan that was adopted for 2020-2024. So this is just trying to wrap up that cycle for 2015-2019 time period and put that into context. You know, the presentation is going to be different going forward, consistent to meeting those new strategic policy metrics. And I would note integrated electric, the test metrics, now that we're done with that, we're going to develop new integrated electric metrics to start presenting those as well in the future. And those are, we'll bring those up in Q1 during this entire process, consistent with all the board presentations in regards to rates and policies. And in compliance with our district banking and investment policy, this is our quarterly investment report. I would note that all policy objectives are being met and are in compliance. The one thing I would note is for a consistent message, you know, we budgeted a rate of 2.41. Our actual rate of return was, our yield was 2.60. And it's consistent with the higher cash balances and a higher yield was part of that positive bottom line influence to that. I would like to note that Treasury will likely be back next quarter with requests for signer updates under the banking and investment policy. I believe Heather Island mentioned that a couple times. Just going to one more plug for that awareness. So putting it all together, 2019 results are better than budget, but it's really driven by those unique and infrequent activities discussed earlier. And I just want to say it one last time, without those items, we'd be really close to our budget expectations. That's activity that really is unique. The district's capital plans are significant, and we fell short on the spending in 2019. But we're planning to roll those costs over to future years, and we're expect to utilize that large cash position to fund the five-year plan. We're financially healthy, and we're on track with the financial metrics. But however, the district is forecasting the new debt issuance in 2022, despite the proposed rate increases that we have reflected in those financial forecasts. And the proposed electric rate increase, and it's prudent from a long-term planning perspective. As you can see, we need to borrow the money in the forecast. We have those assumptions of those rate increases in there, and it's a prudent step in the right direction to keep maintaining our strong financial resilience and flexibility. And staff recommend staying the course and executing the 2020 strategic plan goals approved last fall. With that.
Commissioners, any comments, thoughts?
Incredible year.
I'd like to just say two things. One is who would have ever thought we'd get excited about earning 2.6% interest? It just blows me away. But it's a good return. The second thing I want to talk about is the uniqueness of an organization our size that's going through as much refurbishing expense as we are, and to fund that out of pocket with cash. I can't think of another organization that is experiencing the kind of costs and going through the workload that we're going through to refurbish our hydros and can afford to pay that out of cost without having to borrow money. And yet our cash balance continues to grow. Incredible job. Just an incredible job. Very impressive. Thank you.
I'd like to offer a couple thoughts both on this and on the previous performance plan. I think it was a really very good year for the district in terms of its overall financials, no question about that. On the other hand, it was a disappointing year in terms of our capital expenditures. We just did not accomplish what we wanted to accomplish this year. Lots of reasons why, but as Mark and Craig said, what's happening is we're now rolling those costs over into the next few years. It's just creating a bigger bow wave of expenditure, particularly over the next 3 years as we try to catch up on, in particular, the hydro units. I will say the strategic plan looks pretty good right now, given where we are, by starting off with focusing on investments in our assets and people. That clearly is the highest priority coming out of the summary of where we ended up in 2019. So it seems like we've got the right things identified there. And we'll add just one other point that I think is getting a lot more attention. The board's request that we emphasize innovation, I think, has taken the organization in an interesting way, seeing a lot of responsiveness to that. And so the one place that I would expect that we might be underscoring even more than the strategic plan did is where we'd be moving with technology over the course of the next few years. So I expect you'll be hearing more from us about that. But with that, I feel like we've got the right plan to be able to move forward, given what we're seeing both end of year performance and end of year financials.
Yeah, good work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, we want to provide a legislative update. Tracy Yunt and Sean Seaman will be presenting.
Good morning. Tracy Yunt, Director of External Affairs. Sean Seaman with External Affairs. So just a very short overview. Here we are already third or fourth week, it seems, into the session. But it is a 60-day session. It ends March 12th. And we are coming upon the very first cutoff date. This Friday will be for all the policy bills to make it out of their committees of origin. So it's a significant date for me personally because the health of my long list of bills does drop. But also significant for all those parties involved because we start focusing on the bills that truly should be focused on. The second cutoff is just a week later, less than a week later, and that's for the fiscal bills. They start need to move out of their respective fiscal committees. Things start happening very quick right now. The main issues that we're focusing on, and Tracy's going to dig a lot more into this first item, the non-oil turbine hub, the whole research and development funding for that. This is a bill that we are requesting, and Tracy's been heavily engaged in, as well as Steve. Energy legislation, of course, is always out there for utility, but we've seen, again, as we've seen in the past, considerable HR legislation. There's public records bills, there are purchasing bills, there are lands bills, and there's been things related to our fleet. So we're tracking all these and weighing in as necessary on these different bills. Sorry.
All right, so we're going to spend a few slides, a few minutes talking about something our generation group is looking into, which is developing a research program to advance non-oil turbine hub lubricating technology to achieve a 40-year design life. That's a mouthful, but it's pretty cool. So right now, this technology of using something other than oil is used in Sweden and Japan and very minor testing in the United States, less than 10 units. The problem is that it doesn't result in the same unit life. It's drastically reduced. Initially, when it was first tested, it was down in the 10 years, going from 40 years to 10 years. So that makes it really expensive. So what we're looking for and the goal is to extend, use some new technologies to extend the useful life going to oil-free. So what does this mean? There are a lot of facilities up and down the Columbia River, but specifically for us, it would lead to removal of substantial amounts of lubricating oil currently that's within a single barrier to a river. So at Rocky Reach, both Rocky Reach and Rock Island are similar. There's some minor differences, but that's about 3,200 gallons per unit at Rocky Reach. We'd have two units that we'd be proceeding with initially. And Rock Island, potentially up to eight units with about 2,000 gallons. So if the R&D program works out, if the technology works out, we're looking at about 22,400 gallons with the first 10 units. So what you're looking at here is a cross-section of one of the hubs. You can see over on the right with the blades, the schematic doesn't have the blades on it. But what we're talking about is where the light green, that is where it currently has the lubricating oil. And it's mineral oil. It's kind of like baby oil. It's clear. But it's not as good as, from an environmental standpoint, as other things like water or air or other things. So what we're looking at is, you see that little ring, the bearing, that is one of the places where there have been releases. And so this is a effort to replace that lubricating oil reservoir with something else. So why now? It takes a lot of money to tear down a unit. And we are in the process of rehabbing units. So from Chelan PUD's perspective, now's the time to make some changes if the changes are going to be made. Also, why now? Why didn't we do this in the past? Well, we looked several years ago. Brett and other folks went around the world really looking at other technologies, but there's been some recent advancements in metallurgy and coatings from industry. And also, something kind of exciting is some bushing technology that's used by DOD in helicopter rotors and submarine shafts. So you can see some similarities just with what we're talking about. And can that technology now be adapted to a hydro environment, to Chelan PUD's Columbia River hydro environment specifically? So with all the work that engineering and generation and others are doing at the district, that has translated into a potential legislative objective. And that is to partner with the state of Washington to help fund an R&D program intended to extend the design life of non-oil turbine hub lubricating technology. What we're looking for is a state contribution that essentially is a remittance of the state portion of the sales tax for the taxable elements of these projects. The PUD is taking on a great amount of risk, including development of an R&D program. There's going to be design issues. You're testing new technology. We have to monitor, test, and risk damage to units if things don't work. So there are some unquantifiable things that could happen, and that's the in-kind component of what the PUD is contemplating to offer up. Here are some draft numbers that will likely change, but for Chelan PUD, these are just estimates now, and nothing is set in stone for sure at Rock Island or Rocky Reach. But this is roughly the taxable portion of the project cost at Rocky Reach and Rock Island, and it's simply a matter of taking 6.5%, multiplying it by that per year, which gets you the remittance amount. For 5 years, that equates to about $8.8 million. That would be the legislative state portion of the bill. We didn't anticipate this in the interim. This is a recently developed idea, a few weeks old. Representative Gaynor has done a tremendous job of building on a lot of work last session by Senator Hawkins. If Senator Hawkins hadn't moved the concept of tax parity like he did, we wouldn't have been able to start where we started. These two together have created a real opportunity where at the beginning of this, when Steve held out the challenge, I thought, wow, we're like a week before the session and we're going to float this idea. But where things may have started to change was not only the merits of the idea, but also the work Representative Gaynor did in gaining some sponsors. And I just want to pause for a second. 16 sponsors with an idea that came up 3 weeks ago that includes the chair of the Environment Committee and the chair of the House Finance Committee, Republicans and Democrats. So if you were going to script out a good set of sponsors, this would be it. We still have more work to do, clearly. And there's more information being shared with each of these sponsors, the fiscal impact, the details of the bill. So there's a lot of work to do, but it's a good spot to be in right now. We're set for a hearing on February 7th in the House Finance Committee. I'll be over there describing what we are working on and why. We're also engaging ecology on this topic. They are very interested in the idea of removing tens, if not hundreds of thousands of gallons from single barrier, essentially single contained operations on the Columbia River. And so what we've asked is how or could they be willing to share their interest from a regulatory perspective of pursuing this R&D effort. So we're working with them to see if that's something that they can communicate to legislators. This bill is also not subject to committee cutoff dates. And like I said, there's a lot of work to be done in the coming weeks for sure. Before we go, we have other, Sean needs to cover some other items. Is there anything on the oil-free or non-oil lubricating technology?
Just a comment that you've made a lot of progress in the last couple of weeks. You know, when we talked at the legislative reception a couple of weeks ago, that was just being popped on them at that moment in time. That's impressive.
Yeah, Representative Gaynor just going around and talking to folks and getting that sponsor list and our people on the ground, including Sean in Olympia, wouldn't be possible without him.
So moving on, there's numerous, as you would suspect, energy bills. You hear about those at the WAPUTA meetings, and Friday Facts talks about these. We're just going to focus on a couple here today just as a snapshot. Utility disclosures, just an idea. So many of these bills come out of a situation. Somebody didn't like something at some point. And here's a bill we're not quite ready, haven't been able to find out what the source of this is. But it would result as utilities having to do a lot more work around rate increases. We do, if you look at the bill, we do a very good job meeting the intent of this particular bill, but it would ask us to do more and be very specific about how we do it. Certain postings on our website, newspaper postings, et cetera. So it takes what we do and maybe goes beyond that and has requirements. Again, this comes back down to this idea of local control and us trying to do what we think is right for customers. But when some utilities weren't doing much, you end up with a bill. So just tracking this one at this point. The Clean Energy Transformation Act, CETA in this case, the idea here is to do some reliability studies to say, how is the industry doing as we make the transformation to clean energy? Are we still maintaining the reliability that we believe the region needs? So this is a bill by being sponsored by Senator Sheldon. He's also reaching out across the aisle and has concurrence with the chair of the Energy Committee, Senator Carlisle. And it's undergoing some changes, but the idea was there'd be some regular assessments of how the industry is doing with reliability, whether it be through a resource adequacy study or some other means. And they're working on the details, how that study would be done and how to report back to the legislature. But it seems to be moving forward with positive input from others, including utility industry. Community solar, in this case, was an idea that came out of a group out of Olympia, and is to expand community solar to have more access for low-income customers. There's been support of the idea of community solar, but this particular bill started with a mechanism on how we would basically net meter these customers, and it didn't work for any utility because you would end up having to do a considerable amount of manual input each month as opposed to how we would do something with SNAP, which is once a year. There'd be a monthly reconciliation with this manually. So we haven't seen the new bill, but we expect to see that out soon, and it addresses this issue that we just spoke about meter aggregation, net metering. Human resources, again, there's many bills. We're just going to talk on one as an example, this long-term care. A couple years ago, the state passed a long-term care program that made any employee in the state eligible for this. And this bill is trying to carve out people that employees that have a plan. You can take an exemption from that at this point, so you're not paying into it. But this bill would say once you've exempted, you're exempted for life, no matter what happens if you change employment to another utility or another company. So we're just an example of we're seeing things from previous bills now being changed. And here's a case of the long-term care bill a couple years ago, and there are those modifications to this. So we keep seeing something new coming into the realm along with these human resources. Same with paid family medical leave. There are some changes to that bill this year as well. So it's an ongoing process. New bills, changes to previously and recently added bills and laws to the state. There were other things that we do work on, and broadband is one of them. Last year, recall, we had the broadband bill passed. It developed the broadband office, provided more money to the Public Works Board for grants and loans to get rural broadband out. There was no funding this year, though, for the broadband office. They hired Russ Elliott. I think you have met him at the Waputa meeting. He just doesn't have the resources to do what he needs to do, including trying to figure out where we are with broadband in the area and also going after more money. So there's an effort by Waputa in particular to try and get more money into the budget for him. Forest health, I think Tracy was going to touch on this one a little bit real quick.
Yeah, so this is a bill last year, similar bill that Waputa supported. This year, Commissioner Franz has a proposal of basically $5 per insurance policy, and the objective that they communicated to us was that they'd like a consistent revenue mechanism that linked the 10-year Wildland Fire Protection Strategic Plan and the Forest Health Plan into what they're actually going to do. So they're linking their plans with their money so they can accomplish what they're trying to accomplish. There is another proposal you may hear about. When I talked to Commissioner Franz's folks, they're supportive of the idea of getting some funding, but they see it as less certain, and it only focuses on the forest health, but not the wildland fire protection. So of the two proposals that are out there, Commissioner Franz is supportive, obviously, primarily of the bill that she has requested.
I do want to mention Commissioner Franz called to ask for our support for this bill. Looking specifically, she knows that we've been leaders on the wildland fire issues, and so she was interested in hearing from Chelan PUD. We had been supporter last year, so I told her we were supportive last year. We'd be looking at specifics, but if any of you have thoughts about that, you can let me know at any time.
For a point of clarification, the $5 per insurance policy, is that homeowner policy?
It's intended to be property and casualty policies as well.
Thank you.
Yep. And we can verify that, but that's what I think that's pretty certain is property and casualty. Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks,
Adam. Thank you.
Okay. Our last item for the study session this morning is we have been working for a while to try to complete land acquisitions out near the new service center so that we'd be able to potentially expand the Apple Capitol Loop Trail. And, Dan Frazier has some good news for you today about where we are on that. This would ultimately, depending on your reaction today, could be a resolution that comes forward at the next board meeting.
Morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Service. I'm glad Steve introduced it as good news because I thought it was good news. It's been a long process. So today, what I have for you is a presentation about a final acquisition, a final piece to be acquired. Give us a background, talk a little bit about the property and what it does for us, talk about the resolution that Steve previewed there, and then next steps and a little kind of a sneak of what's going on the Service Center project. This is for information only, no action required today. So as you recall, over the last few years, we've been accumulating the properties to do the Service Center project, and the first one really came in back in 2001. There was a piece that was acquired for a potential substation site, and that was acquired from the port, and it's a little sliver along the river or along the highway down to the river. And then, of course, in 2019, the larger acquisition of the port properties, the former Horan Orchard block, and the land to the north of Old Station Road. And later in 2019, we purchased the Tontini property that, as you can see, got us right down to the river, except one little piece left, and that's what this piece is that little piece down at the bottom that gives us the complete river access. As Steve mentioned, this gives us the ability to extend the loop trail into this area. Also provides us some unique opportunities around that parcel in particular. So here's a close-up of the parcel itself. It's about a quarter acre. It's got a 1,000-square-foot house, 1,100-square-foot house on it. It has been occupied, although the tenant was moving out just last week. Now, what's really interesting about this piece and the other pieces, if I go back to this, from the, if you follow my cursor here, from the bridge all the way along the river here, there's a 25-foot fishing easement. And so what this gives access to that fishing easement, which was only previously able to be accessed from the river. So you can bring a boat up and fish from the bank, but you didn't have a way of physically getting down to that easement because it was all private ownership along there, and there was no public access to the waterfront itself. So with our plans of getting all this in the PUD ownership, and then we can provide hopefully trail access and maybe even some additional viewing access. So one of the reasons we like this parcel is it's in the riparian zone, but there's actually a structure on it. So that structure is grandfathered in to the development moratoriums around work in the riverfront. And so what this allows us to do is potentially be able to put something like a gazebo or a viewing platform or something else on that site. And it's been talked about for quite a while as to do something that would pay homage to the Haran House itself. So we don't know what that looks like. We've actually just engaged with some discussions with the local architect about, you know, someone that really knows the history of the Haran House and the architecture. What could we do on this site? And we're working with the city to make sure we understand what we could do with this house footprint as it currently sits, and do we need to keep a portion of the house or just the foundation, or do we have the area that's currently delineated as a location for a viewing platform? And then also, just down at the very bottom of this, there's a low bank access that comes with this property, and so we could actually provide physical access. It comes across the Tontini property, but then down onto this property. So really key piece for us to be able to provide the recreational opportunities that we've been talking about throughout this project.
Does that 25-foot fishing easement, is that from normal high water or from what point?
It's from ordinary high. Ordinary high water.
Ordinary high water. Yeah, right. As calculated by whom?
As set forth in the, it was part of the, the project boundary is coincident in that area to the ordinary high water. So the rights that we have start at the ordinary high water, which I believe is the 622 elevation in that area. So it's from the 622 above.
Dan, as part of the consideration of what to do with this property and on this location, taking into account educational opportunities, the
absolutely.
Uniqueness of it? Yeah.
Absolutely. As we spoke with DAHP quite a while ago about, you know, what opportunities to be down here, we'd love to do something that talks about the river itself, what the PUD has done with fisheries, with habitat, and then, of course, maybe something educational about the area, the Haran history, the Haran orchard, and Michael Haran's influence in the area, things like that.
What a unique opportunity we have.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We thought it was definitely worth pursuing, and we made it eventually. So the purchase terms are $300,000 for the parcel, and we'd be closing on or before March 5th if we were able to bring a resolution to the next commission meeting. So I kind of got into this already. This is the reasons we're looking at this property and how it's vital for the service center and other reasons to acquire the property. For the service center itself, once we have control of all the properties that are serviced by Haran Road, we can approach the city about vacation of Haran Road. And we will actually be doing that in the next couple weeks, be getting with the city to talk about the vacation of Haran Road. And that's really important because we have buildings that go right up to the current Haran Road right away, so there's setback issues. For the site security, if you look back at this photo, and we would be able to cut the site access off up here at Old Station Road, and so this would all become internal circulation to the site. So it really helps the security. Rather than having both sides of the road fenced, the road becomes internal to the site, which is really nice to have for a site. Both side security and then utilization. You know, when you have fences, you have to sit back from fences, and you want to be able to utilize the site very efficiently. And circulation, same thing, getting around on the site, it really helps us. There's also the shoreline land use issues that I talked about. So we would have ownership in all the areas for the setback. So we are currently going through what's called a shoreline conditional use permit process, or a SCUP, because we love our acronyms. And the SCUP would require some mitigation. And the more property we own, a more riparian area we own, the truly riparian nature area, it gives us more ability to mitigate and get that favorable decision from both the city and the Department of Ecology. And, of course, from the recreational facility development aspect, it's a great location for extension of the Loop Trail. The city actually identified this as part of, during their Confluence Parkway planning process,
as a logical extension of the loop trail and start a trail going up the river. So they've incorporated that into whatever becomes of the Confluence Parkway itself, to making sure there's the ability to cross under or over Confluence Parkway to connect the trail. Then obviously the existing structure and the trail bank access is two of the other reasons we like for the recreational facility development. So moving forward, we propose bringing a resolution to the February 18th board meeting. We are in that shoreline conditional use permit process, and so we're actually meeting tomorrow to do a final run through the JARPA, another great acronym, that we'll be applying to the city. And this is a unique type of conditional use permit because it does require approval by both the city and the Department of Ecology. The city actually does the process, holds the hearing examiner, and the Department of Ecology just reviews it and confirms or doesn't confirm the decision of the city. So we'll be going through that over the next several months. And then as far as what's next on the site development itself, we're looking to go to the city in June with site development permit applications. So that's the land portion of it. So we'd be doing our site utilities, grading, all the things that go on before you start doing buildings on the site. And then in September, we'd be looking to go to the city with actual building permit applications. So one of the things that I added there at the bottom, one of the things we have to do is obtain the rights to get down to this property outside of the service center footprint itself. So we don't want to run a trail through the service center. So I'll go back to that same picture again. We'd be coming down the east boundary here, and the city owns this parcel that has the stormwater pond and comes all the way down to the river here. So we'd be working with the city and possibly Burlington Northern to obtain permits in order to get down there, and then definitely with Burlington Northern to get under the railroad tracks and then tie back into the trail. Here's the down here is the pedestrian bridge as it crosses, and so we'd be tying in somewhere in this area to the loop trail. Then, of course, Confluence Parkway is shown coming in somewhere between those two bridges. So coordinating with the city and where Confluence Parkway alignment would line up with the trail. So those are really our reasons for doing this. It's a nice little piece of property for us, and it completes the puzzle that we've been assembling down there. Any questions?
Commissioners, questions? Comments?
Carry on.
Okay. Good job. Well, you get to see me in a couple weeks then.
Yeah, very good.
Thanks, Dan.
Actually, unless we hear otherwise, we probably will put this item on consent for the next board meeting.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
So with that, we have completed the study session items. I do see that we've got at least one of the individuals here to conduct one of the Mander items. So I'd like to move to that if we could. Invite John and Carrie to come up and talk about the customer information system. Recall that we did choose to delay the implementation of that. Describe that to you at the last board meeting. They're here to give you an update.
John Sowell, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me, I have Carrie Wendell, Manager of Customer Relations. You may recall last board meeting, we were just talking about having to delay the anticipated go live of the new billing system, the C2M Oracle product. Well, we have good news today. We have the green light, so we're moving forward this Friday to initiate the conversion into the new system. I asked Carrie to come up because she's finally got a little bit of breathing room, and she's really kind of leading the functional side to get us to this point, so I thought it'd be helpful that if she was up here and can kind of just describe a little bit what's going on. But again, we're shooting for next weekend, and probably the interesting point too is we will be closed on Monday on our customer-facing operations. For the same concept to, we'll start doing back office transactions, but just to keep the distractions down and then be open for business on Tuesday. So what have you been up to, Carrie?
I had to run up the stairs because we're in the middle of a meeting talking about all this, what's happening. But first of all, thank you for the support for pushing this out. I know that we've been trying to get this done and keep it on schedule, but I appreciate the support to push it out. The group's worked really hard, and I believe now that with that extra time, it's helped us. I feel like we're at a way better point than we were a few weeks ago. So to help us prepare, as John said, we're going to be closed on Monday to our customers, but we'll be here all weekend starting Friday afternoon. Well, really all week we'll be cleaning out our system, making sure everything is ready to go, getting all the field work back, and just making sure everything is clean for the clean cutover. And then to make sure everything is at a good point, on Monday we have to move all of our systems over to the live, which includes our banking, our online services, our meter reading interfaces. So we'll take care of that all on Monday. The main doors will be open, of course, and we won't do any disconnects on Monday. But definitely this is not the end for us. We're really just beginning. There's a lot of work that's already scheduled after go live, so we'll be pushing on that as soon as we get, as soon as we're live. And we're not sure what issues may arise in the next week or two, but the team is ready to take on the challenge and mitigate whatever we need to keep things going.
Two questions. Are you nervous?
Yeah.
And how many of your team members have scheduled vacations after this?
All of them. Yeah. Anything else?
I would like to note that, you know, Carrie's led up the functional side, which is the customer relations department. They certainly have the bulk of the processes, the testing and the training, but there's a lot of other folks who've been very engaged, a lot of folks in Kelly's group, both on the IT side and people supporting from finance. So it's definitely been a large lift across many areas.
Carrie and John, when will customers start getting their new bills? When they start showing up in their mailbox or their email box?
Well, really the only change that the customers are, they're not going to see a change on their bills. Their bills should look the same. I mean, everything that we've been testing, I mean, there's no change in our provider. We still have the same bill print provider. The only thing that a customer may see is if they are on, use our PowerPay system. So if they get electronic bills electronically, they'll start receiving their letters electronically. So if they, for example, if they have a water leak, now the water leak process, after they read the meter, then a letter is actually mailed. So now, starting on Monday, if they have a water leak, that will be emailed to them. That letter will be. So they'll get it a little bit faster. But anyone who has chose that option with us is going to start getting all of their correspondence that we can mail to them on Monday.
So customers will start receiving their bills under the new system beginning next Tuesday, Wednesday? Is that right?
Well, once they, yes, they'll process on Monday night, and then mm-hmm. it'll be next week. Yes. Okay.
So obviously, if you hear anything, we'd be interested. I mean, we're trying to keep track as much as possible as to whether there are any issues out there. A lot of testing has been done, but this is the big test.
I think what's interesting, too, and when we went live with the PeopleSoft system back in 2004, we did not have anything like electronic billing. That was just starting to come out, and we're up to close to 50% of our customers receive an email bill. So, and there's a lot of other, you know, again, internet-based transactions, payments. That's just a different world we're in now than we were back in 2004.
Meters and apps and, you know, more usage and more information.
Yeah, as Carrie has mentioned, we're just starting now. Mm-hmm. We're getting the foundation, and now we got to build the house.
Very good. So we received an email about PowerPay, thanking us for being a member and also talking about exciting changes coming in February. I'm assuming that that is what this is referring to.
That is.
Okay, so some notice has already gone out. That's good.
Yes. Went out 6 o'clock last night, I think.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for all your hard work.
Commissioners, if I could, what I'd like to suggest is that I could, we had 11 delegated action items. I think we set a new record at the last meeting. And since we have 5 minutes, actually, I think I could run through those pretty quickly and at least get that part of the agenda taken care of. So first of all,
may I jump in here?
Oh, sure. Yes, please, Commissioner Congdon, please do.
Sorry to interrupt, Steve, but I didn't jump on fast enough. I'm sorry. after Dan's presentation, I had to find my phone and unmute it. But anyway, I just want to say I'm really excited about the fact that we're going to be able to acquire that property. I guess we're calling it the McDougal property. And the fact that there was a structure on it, and so we're going to be able to use that footprint and provide something there, hopefully educational, something that will, provide some kind of better access. And the fact that we may be able to extend the trail and hook into the trail, hopefully we can get those permits, we can get the easements that we need. But I know it's not been easy, and it's not completed yet, but I just want to thank Dan and all of his people for all the hard work on this. I just think it's really prime property. It's beautiful. It's natural. It's going to provide a nature experience for people. So huge thanks. I'm really excited about it.
Good. Thank you. Well, I'm happy to report to you Dan is still in the room, so he got to hear that compliment. And
Oh, yes. Good. Good.
Okay, with that, I'm going to start running through these action items. We had one, Tim Pettit will determine how to improve better staff understanding of safety concern and close call. We're going to bring that back at the April 13th board meeting, to be consistent with our overall review of the actions that we've taken since the fatality. There was an issue with respect to the wanting to hear more about the annual report on safety concerns. So we've got that included in our process now, so it'll be reported on an annual basis. We had one with respect to making sure that Stehekin issues would be presented to the next Tri-Commission agenda. That is taken care of. It will be on, I believe it's an April meeting that's coming up. We also had a request to provide information on the specifics around the load characteristics of the approved 2,000 amps of service in Stehekin. You should have received an email on that, pretty staggering actually when you look at those numbers about just how much 2,000 amps actually translates to in terms of load. I did want to take a moment and just say we did have a request to develop the outreach plan for talking about Stehekin issues. I got a request from Ann that we consider both a March and a either May or June meeting, so we get something out there now for the people who are there, but recognize we're going to miss a bunch of people who won't be there until the summer. We're inclined to think that that's probably the right way to go, but I did want to just test that with the rest of you and make sure that you're aware both that she had made that request and see if you had any other comments you wanted to offer. Not seeing or hearing any, so Commissioner Congdon will be developing our plan based on the comments that you made.
Thank you. Yeah, I talked to Steve McKenna about it, and I think Gary maybe, but I know Steve McKenna was in favor of that as well.
Good. We had a request to provide some information about how the tiered rates in Stehekin work. Eric provided that same day of the meeting. We had a request to provide information about the acreage on the Triad development. Andy Wendell completed that in an email to the board. Dan Frazier was asked to provide some information about the current construction work, how much is awarded to local companies. We're still working on that one. We'll get back to you with that. We had a request to provide information about how the proposed electrical rate impacts and impacted residential cost recovery, the additional line on the graph. Lindsay Mons provided that to the board. We had a request to place an agenda item on the next board workshop around the general counsel's performance evaluation. So Rebecca has placed that on the board workshop agenda. And we had a request to provide a memo from the general counsel regarding charge-offs and write-offs that was in preparation for a resolution coming at this board meeting. You should have received that as well. So with that, we're mostly done with those. A couple of them coming back at a future board meeting.
Okay. Just a question to my fellow commissioners. The email that went out regarding general counsel's evaluation, did that seem satisfactory in terms of a process?
I thought
thought so.
Okay.
Yeah, it sounded good, Dennis.
Okay, thank you.
That was it for our items for this morning.
Okay. Well, I think looking at the clock, it is time to recess for lunch and begin our business session at 1 o'clock. Welcome to the February 3rd, 2020 business session of the Chelan County PUD. I'd like to remind everyone to please take this opportunity to silence any electronic devices you may have brought with you today. We place great value on the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we please ask that you come to the microphone adjacent to myself here, and please state your name and address for the record. And if you would be kind enough, limit your comments initially to 3 minutes so that everyone can have an opportunity to chat. So we are moving right along here, Steve, I think to a public hearing.
Yes.
If you'd like to take it from here.
Great. Thank you. So I want to invite Lindsay Mons to come up. This is the public hearing on electric, water, wastewater, and fiber rates. We have been talking about this for more than a year, so we've been at this for a long time. Lindsay will review some of that history for you and give a short presentation because we have spent a lot of time with the board on this because we wanted to make sure there was time for any public comment that might come in.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities. Let's see the presentation up here. So as Steve mentioned, this is a continuation of the process we've been underway for a while. Today's meeting is a public hearing where we give an opportunity for our customer owners to provide their feedback on the proposals we've put forward. We'll look at the process and the recommendations that came out of strategic planning and open the floor for that feedback opportunity. So this is the tail end of a long journey. We did start the strategic planning process in late 2018, where rates planning was a key discussion for our group. It was included in context documents, the kickoff meetings, all of the various topic, the one various topic team associated with rates, and the outreach that was performed at the time. Using the information that we gathered, we did have a presentation to the board in March of 2019 from our CFO that talked about financial resiliency on our electric system, where it was discussed how the small to moderate rate increases that were included within the topic team discussions would be able to defer any longer, larger electric rate increases that may come to play if we were to incur any of the risk scenarios that we look at, such as low water, low wholesale electric prices, or significant increase in cost. So from that information, the topic team considered various options, including rates, both on the electric side and the water wastewater side, because another question for that topic team was associated with the sustainability of those small systems and subsidizing them going forward. From that information, various questions were asked for the customer survey, which was performed in the summer of 2019. And results from that survey showed that our customers favored the small annual increases over time. 76% of respondents favored that in the order of 3% versus a deferred rate increase, which may occur later, of upwards of 10%. We also received feedback associated with our small systems, water, wastewater, and fiber, where over half of our customers lean towards self-sustainability of those systems. And then another large portion, about a third of the remaining, or the third of the total favoring is balanced with potentially some subsidization. This information was included in our draft strategic plan, which was discussed in various settings, including council meetings, civic groups. We held several open house events where customers could come ask questions associated with that strategic plan, which was eventually adopted by the board in October of 2019. This effort continues the implementation of that plan. The recommendations that were included in there include a 3% increase in revenues on the electric side, 4% in water, 4% in wastewater, and 3% on our fiber system. On the electric system, we also had several other small items associated with rate design. So recommended associated with the analysis was focusing the residential rate increases within the customer charge specifically. So taking the total revenues of that system, applying the 3% increase, and then focusing that in the customer charge, which equates to $1.75 per month per year for the five-year plan. Within the other classes, our rate design recommendation was a flat 3% on average across each of the rate elements, with the exception, of course, of the cryptocurrency energy charge, which is set annually based on market forecasts. And lastly, we recommended deferring the Schedule 36, which is our cryptocurrency class, residential demand charge for at least 1 year, allowing our CIS system to really get in the stable operation before trying to apply that. And we're not seeing a huge increase in residential cryptocurrency at this time, so we think it's a low risk to defer that charge. Finally, on the electric side, recommendation to establish a board-designated fund for the purpose of holding that 3% revenue increase in order to defer any of those larger rate increases in the future. With all these increases in electric, water, and wastewater, we would also recommend increasing the low-income discounts in step with the rate increases, so 3% increase to each of those as well. What this looks like for an average residential bill, on the electric side, it was started at $55 a month, which is our average residential, and increase $1.75 per month per year. So at the end of the plan, would be at $63.75 for that customer. On the water side, it would increase from $52 a month to $62 a month. That's approximately $2 per month per year. And in wastewater, from $77 to $93 for a $3 increase. Just as a reminder, these are all average residential bills, so each of our customers will experience something slightly different. But across the whole, this is what we would anticipate to see. Also on this table are our low-income senior and disabled customer discounts, increasing from $9.25 to $10.70 on the electric side, $9.50 to $11.55 in water, and $10.10 to $12.30 in wastewater. Gary.
Linda, can I just pop in and yes. Want to make a comment more than anything else, and that is that on the electric side, the monthly increase is applied to a base rate, not to a usage rate.
That's correct.
So in my mind, I create the distinction. The usage rate is how much power you use.
Yes.
The base rate really is your infrastructure cost rate.
So the base rate is where we recover our cost of what it takes to be a customer. So your meter reading, some of your infrastructure, be it your specific transformers. But for the most part, the cost of delivering the power is included within the usage rate on the residential side. In our commercial industrial classes, that's where we use a demand charge. But we do not have residential demand charges, so it is all in the usage rate there. So the customer charge is a flat rate. Currently, it's $7.70 a month, and that is the amount on the bill that will increase by $1.75 per month. No change based on usage.
Thank you.
You're welcome. A summary of the feedback we've received as of mid last week. We did receive verbal testimony at our last board meeting. We've received several comments on social media, most of which have come actually through the Wenatchee World's posting of information associated with our last meeting. We've also received about 7 written and verbal or phone calls associated with the plans that we have. All of those direct communications with the PUD, be them written or verbal, have been responded to those customers. So any concerns that they have, we've discussed with them. With that, if you have any further questions or comments, I would turn it back to you, Gary.
Commissioners, any questions, comments?
Maybe it's a question, maybe it's a comment, but I'm not sure. Lindsay, you can help me out. Currently, I know the chart that we saw at our last meeting on our base rate with being 7-something, and of all the utilities in the state, we are by far the lowest on that base rate. I seem to recall that we had a conversation here that we calculate our actual cost for maintaining that infrastructure at closer to $27 than to the $7, and I don't know if John Stoll's in the room or if you, off the top of your head, know if I'm close.
I believe that's fairly close, yes.
Yeah, and so that our, you know, the current customer is actually paying about a quarter of what it costs for that infrastructure on their house.
So sorry, I should have corrected you before. That's actually not the infrastructure cost. That is the cost to be a customer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The infrastructure.
Right.
We also have a shortfall on the infrastructure side, but not associated with the $27. Yes.
But the cost to maintain that on the house overall
would be that the maintenance of it is also part of the usage charge.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Lindsay, I've
just confirmed that I think the key question there was the roughly $27 versus $770.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Right? Yes.
Okay.
Can you clarify that, please?
Yeah, this is what's the full cost of service for the elements of the basic rate that are all of those elements that are included in the basic rate. The full cost of service, we don't have the number exactly in front of us. We're both remembering it. Trying to recall it, but it's in that range of $27 a month. Our current charge is $770.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought that up because that was really the basis of my earlier question in terms of what are the elements of the basic rate and what is the subsidy of the basic rate compared to the electric subsidy. We know that producing the electric power can vary slightly, but let's just throw 6 cents a kilowatt out and we charge 3.2 for residential. So the base rate is roughly in the ballpark of $27 a month, and we charge $7.50. So those, I think, are very important milestones that when we take a look at any kind of rate adjustments, that we understand very clearly what's our cost to produce it, how much are we selling it for, and what's the subsidy that we're providing. And as time marches on, I think that spread widens with inflation just over time.
Yep. So that is correct.
Yeah. So I appreciate that clarification. Thank you. Okay. Well, I think if there are no more questions or comments from the commission, I think it's time to open up to public. Do we have any public in the audience that would like to make a comment or a statement? Dirk, would you like to?
I'd love to.
Please step to the microphone, state your name and your address for the record. And we do ask, please, the first round, limit your comments to 3 minutes to give everyone else a chance.
Really quick. Okay. Dirk White. No.
It should be on.
Is it necessary?
Yeah. 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 We're recording.
Am I on?
Yeah.
I can't tell.
Okay. I think you are.
If you keep it close, it's better.
Dirk Wivinga, 2 Summer Creek, Wenatchee. I have no complaints if we need another $100 a year. I tell all my friends back east, this is free power, free play, and free play around here. My only comment has to do with, it's probably semantics, but when I saw the 3%, I did the math, and 5 years from now, my bill, and pardon the slightly different changes, but my bill will actually go up 36% 5 years from now. That's on an annual basis vis-a-vis what it is today. So I have no argument with the extra $100. I'm just saying let's not conflate a revenue increase of 3% with a, let's say, a billing rate of 3%. How about if we just said it's a billing of $100 a year or $105? That's my only suggestion. I'd say keep up the good work. I love you guys. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Dirk. And you know me. I hate percentages. You know me from years ago. I like the dollar amount.
I didn't start.
I know. Exactly. Yeah. But thank you. Appreciate those comments. Anyone else would like to make a comment? It's your opportunity. No? All right.
Commissioners, we did get one written comment. If there's no other verbal comments, I can't see behind me, so I'm not sure you're good. Okay. And I would like to read it into the record because this one is from Bart Clennon. And, I don't have an address. Unfortunately, he didn't leave one. But he was a member of the topic team. And so it seems worthwhile since he was one of the community members that chose to do a deep dive to read his comment. He just says, I'm very proud of our PUD in the past 10 years or so. Many accomplishments have been made. I think the outreach to the public for input has been terrific. And I think acceptance of the goal, the best for the most for the longest, is something that is hugely significant and something that they follow as they are making important decisions. I personally strongly favor the 3% annual increase in our very low electric rates for a number of reasons. One, we have had no increase for 8 years, and yet labor costs have increased annually, and significant outlays have been required to keep the dams up to date. And also just repairs to cover normal wear and tear means that actually we have had a significant rate decrease over the past 8 years, almost 20%. I think it makes sense to keep the change in rates at least reflecting inflation. Second, also at the 3% per year, it will take about 6 years just to get back to our last rate increase effective rate. He wrote, he inserted something here, so I think I've read that right. Effective rate level when adjusted for inflation. Third, small increases avoid the risk of bigger increases in the future. For example, if we adjusted just for inflation just since the last increase, we'd have perhaps a 22% increase. Fourth, they are recognizing and will be giving attention to those who are less fortunate and can't afford such moderate increases. And finally, I'm very concerned about how having the rates at their present level with no increases for, I believe, I believe 8 years, that government agencies might look at us and argue that because we are using the Columbia River, there should be significant additional taxes or fees charged. Hence, in closing, I fully support this 3% annual increase. This is how we avoid big increases at various times in the future, and to me is a very logical step in managing our huge and wonderful asset.
That's it. Good. Very good.
Yeah. And Dirk, is it Dirk? Yes. I just wanted to say, you know, I agree with you on the dollar amount rather than the percentage, because customers pay bills. They don't pay percentages. And it's very clear to them that their bill's going to go up X number of dollars a month. And so what is 3% of some, you know, figure that is unknown or not understood? So I appreciate your comments.
Commissioners, any other thoughts, comments?
All right. So our next steps in this process, considering feedback received, which will be a fairly quick process here. We would return February 18th, which is the next board meeting, with either additional information if needed or a rate resolution. We do still have our contact information open at contactus@shelandpud.org, and additional information, including details of all of our various rate schedules, how they would be impacted with these proposed rate increases, are available on our website, shelandpud.org, rates planning.
Commissioners, if I could add one other comment just in response to Mr. Clennon's comments, I do want to make clear that one of his last of his four bullets was recognizing and giving attention to those who are less fortunate. We do have continuing work that we intend to bring back to this board, likely as an initial conversation before the end of the first quarter regarding low income, particularly focus on low income energy efficiency programs. And at least the current proposal is that the rate would go into effect no later than December 15th, which will we're trying to figure out how this fits with our new customer information system, a variety of things, but there's going to be a time lag here before we would move forward, even if the board were to move forward with a resolution at the next board meeting. It will give us time to be able to better understand the opportunities to address the low-income issues before any rate change went into effect. That's it.
Lindsay, can I have you maybe just take a second and as long as we're on a recorded line, talk a little bit about the rate stabilization that we're trying to implement on for the future.
For the future. So, yes, the electric revenues that are generated associated with this 3%, though we don't like a percent increase, would be held in a board-designated fund that would be established through the resolution that we'd bring forth in the future or next board meeting. And that would hold those funds so that for a stabilization of sorts for cost in the future.
Thank you. Welcome. Appreciate that.
Can I just ask a question? Well, I've got Lindsay here. Based upon the feedback we have, the percentage we know in water and wastewater is an average, and so that's going to be different for everyone. Mm-hmm. But in using the percentage for the base rate, we use that as a formula, but we know that's $1.75 a month. Right. So there's a fixed rate there. Is we explain what that means to the customer.
That's correct.
Thank you, Steve. And I think I need to explain my dislike of percentages only because they can be misleading and misunderstood. Or dollar amounts make it more clear representation of what's actually the impact. And the impact can be quite small, but the percentage might make it appear to be larger than it really is.
So
that is my source of discomfort with percentages.
Well, the reality is some customers will pay more than 3% and others will pay less than 3%. I mean, that's just the reality of the way this will be applied.
Right.
Yes, and I thought I had that number written down in here, but I'm not seeing it. I can get you the exact or approximate kilowatt hour number that where the customers below that would see effectively greater than 3%, and above that less, but all $1.75.
All right.
Can a peanut gallery step in here just for some to answer your question?
Yeah. If you'd please use the microphone again and state your name and address again, please.
Dirk Wybinga, 2 Summer Creek. When I did the math, I have the good fortune to go through roughly 9,000 kilowatt hours a year. The average guy, if you will, the 3% guy, he does, we'll say, 2.5 times that. When I put in, I wonder who's going to get the 1% rate increase. That guy's going to use 800%, over 70,000 kilowatt hours. So on the surface, it appears to be a disincentive to conservation on the surface. If you present the business case, of course, that goes all out back to the percentage.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining.
Thank you, Dirk.
I think with that, we're ready to close this public commentary.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lindsay. Appreciate it.
With that, I believe we are ready to move on to the consent agenda.
Okay.
I would move approval of the consent agenda, which now includes resolution number 15.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The ayes have it. Okay. So I guess we're moving on to manager items.
Yeah, I'm just pausing for a moment to let the crowd settle. We are at the regular agenda, which would be agenda item 11, a resolution approving bidding documents for Rock Reach Intake Headgates, bid number 19-86, and authorizing the general manager of the district to publish notice inviting sealed proposals for said project. George Velasquez will be presenting. You may recall that we provided a presentation to the board at the prior meeting on this subject.
Good afternoon, George Velasquez, Manager, Engineering and Project Management. So this bid includes fabrication, delivery, on-site erection of one whole new set of intake headgates. If you recall, headgates are on the upstream side of the dam.
If you take a look at this picture, they go in these slots right here, and that basically effectively shuts down any upstream water going.
The current ballpark estimate is currently estimated around $2.75 to $3.2 million. So I just want to make sure we all understand that we might be back here again after bids come in, if it's over $3 million, for approval to award. We did build a set in 2015, similar, except they had different roller bearings, different bushings, different axles, and they were used strictly for emergency use. So there were the roller system and the bearings were much more robust so that we could use them in an emergency runaway unit situation. The ones that are being designed now or are designed slightly different. So the current outage plans for the next few years, I think everybody understands that we move from the large units to the small units. The small units are currently having trunnion seal issues. So this new set of gates will be a bushing type, not a roller bearing type head gate. The current operation at Rocky Reach is we have one emergency set, which I just mentioned. We have two sets for long-term overhaul work, such as we're planning for C2 and C7. And then we have one set for just ongoing operation and maintenance and inspection type. So this fifth set would allow us to continue our annual operation, maintenance, inspection work, and in addition, allow us to take out two units at once like we're planning, C2 and C7. Without an additional set of intake gates, unplanned work will certainly be impacted if unplanned work comes up. Without supplying more capacity to unwater units, the district will certainly risk unplanned work interfering with current small unit program. The whole dewatering system includes not only head gates, but also includes what we call stop logs. They're draft tube gates that we put on the downstream side. And it also includes dewatering pumps. So during our investigations, during the feasibility, we found that we had adequate equipment for everything, with exception of obviously the head gates. So that's why we're here today.
Commissioners, questions?
Just want to reiterate that we did a fairly extensive economic analysis on this, and with a fairly modest assessment of risk that we might use another one of the C1 through 7 units that we've had problems with on oil releases, this is a very cost-effective investment.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, George.
Agenda item 12 is a resolution rescinding resolution number 08-13327 and delegating authority regarding charge-offs and write-offs. We've had some conversation about this already, and Commissioner Bowles raised a question earlier. This is an issue that's been managed by Eric Walquist through time. Unless there is an issue or a question, we do not have an additional presentation to make on this. And so just open to whether there's a question that should be addressed.
Any comments, questions, clarification?
Staff has worked real hard to make me happy.
That's good.
And they've succeeded.
Okay. Do we need a motion?
We can do it at the end and capture the ball.
Okay. So,
then we'll move to Agenda 13, a resolution adopting regulatory accounting for significant investment in non-district owned assets. Diane Cyree will be presenting.
Good afternoon. Diane Cyree, Director of Accounting and Controller. And because you, as a governing board, establish rates that are designed to recover costs of providing a service, the district qualifies for the use of regulatory accounting to defer certain revenues and expenses and recognize them in the financial statements as they will be reflected in rates. So in order to adopt regulatory accounting, the board needs to approve each type of activity. And over the past 10 years, you have approved six other activities. You may recall we adopted regulatory accounting for conservation expenditures, significant contributions in aid of construction, swap termination payments, investment fair value changes, derivatives, and debt issuance costs. So this is the, today we're talking about the seventh activity that we're requesting or recommending regulatory accounting for. And this occurs in those instances where it's in the district's best interest to and our customers' best interest to invest in assets that another entity will own and maintain. And we typically do this if the district's going to benefit directly or indirectly by that investment. One example is the transmission facilities that are owned and operated by individual facilities or utilities, but they're jointly used through mid-sea transmission agreements, Douglas, Grant, EPA, and us, for example. We all benefit by these investments, and so we agree to share in the costs constructing those assets. We do have a couple big transmission contracts that you're well aware of, but this could happen in any area of the district. And we are expecting the investments to be pretty significant the next couple of years, about $14 million. So without adopting regulatory accounting, we would have to expense those to our financial statements as they're incurred. So obviously that's a mismatch between how we expect to recover those through rates. So by adopting regulatory accounting, we can defer those costs to the balance sheet and amortize them over the expected life of the asset, or when we're going to receive that benefit and recover through our rates. And so that matches it better with our rate setting process. So the net impact to the financial statements, that if we own those assets, we would capitalize them and depreciate them. So this is very similar to how we would recognize those in our financial statements as if we owned them. And there's no impact to our forecasted cash flows, bottom line results, or ability to meet our financial metrics by this accounting change. It's just purely a classification change. Instead of being showing up in our plant balance, they'll be in a category called regulatory assets. And this practice is supported by our external auditors and was discussed with the audit committee last week with no concerns. And we, as you saw this morning, it is reflected in the preliminary financial results you saw and will be reflected prospectively going forward, and very transparent and disclosed in our footnotes. And let's see. I think that's all I had to share. So I guess in summary is that the investment in these non-district owned assets by using regulatory accounting, it is more meaningful financial results and better aligns with our rate setting processes. Any questions?
Commissioners,
no
questions?
I have a comment, Gary.
Yes, Ann, please. Commissioner Congdon.
Hi. Yes. I just wanted to say, Diane, thank you. That was a great explanation. That was very concise and clear, and I mean, great clarity. So good job. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And you had the benefit of hearing it at the audit committee last week.
So. Well, that's true. I did.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, resolution 14 is a resolution authorizing change order number 17 to contract number 02-23 with Open Systems International Incorporated to provide an upgrade of the SCADA EMS system and to implement an advanced distribution management system. Chad Bowman's going to be presenting. I have to say this is one I'm excited about because we mentioned this morning that I feel like the technology initiative, the innovation the board had sought out. We've seen some really strong positive reaction within the district from a variety of employees. This is one of those, the implementation of really direction the board gave a little more than a year ago. That, Chad, turn it over to you.
Chad Bowman, Director of Transmission.
Zach Milden, Control Systems Engineer.
Zach is going to do all the real work on this project. Work. And he's done a lot of good work so far. So like Steve said, this is a resolution to authorize the general manager to enter into a change order with Open Systems International. They're our current SCADA vendor for this advanced distribution management system software for an amount of it's approximately $1.8 million. As you can see on the screen here, what is ADMS? It's really this common platform that we're working to develop that integrates to a lot of other district systems to really provide that common operating picture to the various business units, system operations, line crew dispatch, the communications department, and most importantly, the customer, right, and provide greater visibility into what is going on with the system and their particular outage and how long their outage might last. I thought about creating a different slide. This shows a lot of arrows going a lot of different ways. The current, if you wanted to really kind of think about the current system, it would be that top middle box system operations with a lot of arrows with phones connecting it, where if you want to really know what's going on, you have to call system ops or vice versa. So this will share that information much more broadly. It does include a lot of heavy lifting integrations with our geographic information system, our customer information system, AMI, once that is deployed, and future integration to a customer portal. So what does ADMS provide? We think it saves will save the customers money due to reduced outage times, increases outage visibility. There's a web-based outage map that will have estimated restoration times on it. Once it's integrated to AMI, we will no longer rely on customers calling us to know that we have an actual outage. We've had a long-term goal in system ops to move from paper maps to electronic. That will aid with that. And finally, there's a mobile platform for the field crews to really be looking at the same types of information that system operations is looking at. Questions?
I have one. I've been around long enough now that I know virtually all of the acronyms, but I'm embarrassed to say that probably the one that's been around the longest, I don't know. What does SCADA stand for?
System Control and Data Acquisition.
Okay. All the others I know, which is amazing.
That's impressive.
No. So Chad, say a second about what that does.
So we currently have a SCADA system. It's provided by OSI. And what that does is every 4 seconds it polls or interrogates what it's another acronym, remote terminal units in all the substations, which provide breaker status, how many amps, how many megawatts, all of those type things back to system ops. And it also provides a method for system ops to control those devices remotely.
Okay. Chad, would you go back for a second to the other page? I just want to pause for a second and talk about how important this is. So smart meters is really a valuable tool, right? It tells us a lot about what's going on in the field. But when you want to connect up all that information, particularly to customers, it's going to take another step. This is the other step. This is the way for customers to be able to understand what's going on with their outages. So the goal here has been to try to do this in parallel rather than in sequence. So we'll be moving forward with smart meters. We're moving forward with ADMS. We're going to see how quickly we can get ADMS out there once we get smart meters fully implemented. Really appreciate that this is a challenge this group took on less than a year ago to start thinking through how can we make all this stuff work. And they've found a really terrific contracting vehicle that is going to allow us to go a lot faster than if we had just gone out broadly and RFP'd and started from scratch and tried to figure this out. We've got a vendor here we've worked with regularly through time, have confidence in. The ability to be able to use them and move forward means that we're going to get to the opportunity to potentially provide something to our customers a lot sooner than otherwise we've been able to.
I would like to add to that. I just had an opportunity to listen to a number of other utilities that have been implementing ADMS projects, and one of the biggest hurdles a number of them encountered if they were using multiple vendors is a lot of the functionality that we're looking for was limited because of communication protocols between the two different products and stuff. So this will definitely allow us to move this project forward faster and hopefully come out with a better product in the end.
So I don't have any question on the rationale and the reason for doing that, but just talk to me about the change order. So we're going from what to what? What's that change order? What's changing?
Mm-hmm. So fortunately, when we initially procured our current SCADA system back in 2002, 2003, The folks that did that had enough foresight to put into that contract 18 years ago, 17 years ago, something called a distribution management system, which is really akin to what's now the advanced distribution management system, which includes these outage management system components. So we were able to, so we had that in the contract, you know, 2003, 2004. We were never able to fully implement that. Back then, technology's come a long ways. This product has come a long ways. So it's a change order to that contract that was negotiated back then.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Well, this is going to be exciting.
Yeah, it will be.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And with agenda item 15 having been moved to the consent agenda, that's it for the regular agenda items.
Okay. So we're moving on to commission items.
Whoops. You got to vote.
So I move to go ahead and approve items 11, 12, 13, and 14 as detailed.
Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
Aye.
The ayes have it.
Great. With that, we are ready to move. We have two more manager items. Let's jump in and have Chad come back up. He's going to give us an update on what's called the McKenzie-Beverly line.
I can take one and get back up here. Thank you for that. So just wanted to provide the board an update on the McKenzie-Beverly line, which another way to think about it, it runs from Leavenworth to over by Everett. You might remember 3 or 4 weeks ago, up over Stevens Pass, Plain, Lake Wenatchee, Coles Corner. 3 weeks ago, you might remember three-ish weeks ago, the pass was closed for 4 days, heavy snow, storms, wind. During that snow event, Puget's equipment right on the west side of the pass sustained quite a bit of damage. It's been out of service since then. They advise that it's probably out of service through the end of February, at least. And usually when the line is tied through, energized from one end to the other continuously, we can backfeed for outages. So if there's an outage on our side of the hill, or our side of the pass, we can backfeed from Puget to restore service rather quickly. That option currently isn't available, so outages that occur, particularly between Coles Corner and Leavenworth, will likely result in extended outages for the customers in those areas. We're particularly concerned Sunich and Dead Horse Canyons, where there's difficult access anyway. We have taken out our contingency plans for that area, looked at them, talked to the railroad. Railroad is one of our access alternatives for there, where we might rail equipment in. Puget is actually doing that as a result of their outage. wanted to let you know that those customers might have some extended duration outages. We are talking to Puget on a weekly, daily basis. They've got a contractor set to go in there. And they anticipate working 6/12s to restore their side, but we'll see what the weather does. We'll see how hard it really is to get in there for them.
And, Chad, are Puget customers out of power in that area?
They are not. So there's an open section of line between Scenic, the railroad tunnel, and the top of Stevens Pass, which is where Puget's facilities are impacted.
So the reason I say that is they're working 6/12s. They're not working around the clock at this point because they don't have customers out on their side. We don't have customers out on our side. So it's just an exposure that we're not accustomed to having right now. Right. Because of that, we're going to be doing some additional outreach to customers in that area just to let them know that the difficult snow conditions that occurred on the west side do have implications for our operation as well. Hopefully all will go well and no one will ever notice. But just in case, we want them to be aware.
And by the way, I drove over Stevens Pass 2 days after it opened back up, and it did look like a war zone. It was that was ugly over there.
That's what I hear.
All right. Good.
Thank you,
Chad.
Thanks, Chad.
Next up, we want to give you an update on Rock Island Powerhouse 2. John Seigers is going to come up. So just pause for a moment. I can't say for certain, but if memory serves me right, this will be the largest contract offered in my tenure here at the district. I would guess maybe in all of yours as well. So this is a lot of work for a long period of time that we've been setting up, and a tremendous level of effort has gone into just preparing to get ourselves in a position to select a vendor. John will be reviewing some of that, but most importantly, describing our path forward.
Thank you, Steve. So again, I'm John Sagerster, engineering manager at Rock Island and the program manager for Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation efforts. As Steve mentioned, we're using an alternative procurement method called design build. It's allowed under the RCW Section 3910. And right now we're really in what's called the request for proposal or RFP stage. And it's what we use or are using to select which contractor we want to partner with over the next whatever 10 years or so that this project's going to go on. We have received proposals from three finalists. We received those on January 24th, and we're in the process of evaluating those right now. The evaluation process is broken into three different stages. There's the technical, the cost factors, and the interviews. Each aspect of the evaluation is evaluated against our published project goals. Our project goals are, we have five of them. It includes the project team, enhanced safety culture, environmental protection and stewardship, guaranteed service life or warranty, and predictable cost and schedule. So everything we evaluate is how do they help us achieve these five goals. So the technical evaluates all of their design and all the contents of their proposal against the five goals. Each goal is equally weighted and valued throughout the process. And each aspect of the technical proposal submitted is reviewed by district stakeholders as well as subject matter experts. It's the biggest portion of the evaluation. It accounts for 60% of all the points possible in the evaluation process. And it's scheduled to be completed on Monday, February 10th. Following that, we have a public opening, so to speak, of the cost factors. And the cost factors provide us numbers that help us determine what is the overall life cycle cost for their design, the design build fee, and a few other numbers like that. It is public, so the numbers that they submit will be opened, read aloud, recorded, and published. They are not the cost of the proposal or what the cost of the project will be. There's quite a bit of calculations that need to be performed in order to determine what their score is relative to the costs and what kind of indication it may be for the guaranteed maximum price of the first unit and subsequently all eight units. The cost counts for 20% of the overall evaluation score, and that's scheduled to open and be scored by on February 14th. The following Friday. Following that, we have interviews, and the interviews are really a face-to-face discussion, question and answer session that allows the finalist one last opportunity to make sure that their design and their proposals is well understood by the district, as well as gives us an opportunity to ask any questions to get clarity on things that we're interested in. Due to the size and the importance of this particular project, we expect senior managers and executives from each of the finalists to be present, as well as their design team, their project managers, and several of their other staff. The interviews are scheduled for February 18th, 19th, and 20th, and they account for 20% of the overall evaluation as well. So following the completion of all three of those stages, then we select our most highly qualified design builder, is the term that's phrased, and we send notifications to all three finalists with a summary of their score and who's been selected as the most highly qualified. So Those notifications are currently scheduled to go out on March 6th. The most highly qualified is the one really that we select to begin negotiations with. So at that point in time, then we're able to enter into negotiations with that contractor for the terms and conditions of the contract, as well as what's called the pre-construction phase, which is really when we get into detailed design of the project. It's during, so contract negotiations is scheduled to begin March 16th. And we expect that to take 2 months or so. So we would probably be back in June timeframe. And at that point in time, that's when we'd come with resolution action with a request to enter into a contract with that particular finalist or contractor. Following that, that's the pre-construction phase, and that's when we get into life cycle analysis and other types of evaluations to make sure that we have the right scope, finish the design for that particular scope of work, and then one of the unique aspects of this is we base our guaranteed maximum price on a final design rather than, you know, when we're at 10% design and a normal design bid build, we're going to be at 80, 90% complete design before we come back with, here's what the contract's going to cost for one unit. We expect that to last 6 to 12 months. So from the time you guys authorize us to enter into a contract till the time we come back with, here's what it's going to cost to do the work, could be 6 to 12 months. That's where we're at. Wow. Questions?
We really wanted to just make sure you had a sense of what's coming. There's some fairly big things coming over the course of the next couple of months, give you some visibility over that, ask any questions you might have.
So how many years do we anticipate this contract may last?
About 10 years. So from the time we enter into a contract in June here of 2020, we really expect the contractor to be completed with the outage work around the end of 2029. That's all 8 units.
So 10 years is a significant amount of time.
It is.
How do we as an entity judge what we think that company might be like 5, 6, 7 years down the road?
That's a great question. That is a great question. So we ask a lot of questions and requested a lot of plans and forethoughts from the finalists in that area. So financial status, we look at that. Our risk department's looking at that, making sure that they are a viable company financially, that they're going to be around for the long haul. So that's one aspect. Another one is succession planning, their staff.
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to have the engineering staff to make sure that they can complete the project? So that's another area that we look at to make sure that they're viable for the next 10 years.
Big.
It is big. Yep. Other questions?
I just want to comment. That's a great question, Commissioner Smith. Excellent question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm a farmer. What do you? I look 10 years down the road.
Yep.
So we'll be keeping the board informed as this moves along. You can see the decision point doesn't really come till early summer for the board itself, but we want you to have some visibility over how this is evolving.
Right.
Trying to keep it on schedule as well.
Yeah.
It may sound like, well, you got 10 years, but we got units that we need to get after. We know that these units are nearing end of life and important to get the work done.
Yep.
Yeah. I appreciate the communication because before it gets to us, there's a lot of decisions that are being made on selection and
there are
negotiations, and so it's a big deal.
I do want to say one other thing. You got a presentation at the last board meeting about how the new alternative contracting mechanisms are working for us. I would say this is the best example so far of
thank you.
Being able to learn a lot as we go along, as opposed to us having just written a spec. The oil free option in particular is one that we've learned a ton from
these
vendors. Maybe you could say something about that, John, because it's come up. We talked a little bit about oil free this morning as
sure.
well.
Yeah, so we've learned a lot about the oil-free turbine options. All three of the finalists have different designs. Some of them even have multiple design options that they're able to present to us and have in production elsewhere in the world. It is a fairly common option for oil-free turbine hubs in Europe, particularly Scandinavia, as well as in Japan, in Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, places like that. So they have these in production all over the world. The three main variations are air-filled, which is probably the least common, filled with demineralized water, or partially filled with the demineralized water, which is, you know, kind of the next most popular, and then the most popular one is completely filled with water with an additive to help with corrosion. So it's a corrosion inhibitor, like a propylene glycol or something else along those lines. Hmm.
Is the air system a pressurized?
It's not. Most of them are not pressurized. They're atmospheric air. So you don't end up, you know, blowing air out into the river. If there's a seal failure, you know, you've heard of our trunnion seals, where we have problems with the trunnion seals in the air system. And quite frankly, in both the water systems, the most likely scenario is that it would leak in, because they're separated now from the hydraulic pressure of the piston that drives the position of the blades. Not as costly as we expected. That was one of the other things that we're learning from this. The technologies that they use to convert it to oil-free hubs, a lot of the same type of bushing materials that we use elsewhere in our plants, like on our greaseless operating ring bushings, our greaseless wicket gate stem bushings, things like that. So there's nothing new under the sun here. It's a lot of the same technologies that we have elsewhere in our power plant. It's just in a position where if it fails, it's pretty costly to get at it.
So great opportunity to learn.
So yep, absolutely.
So the process is working really well for us.
Other questions?
Just a quick question about heat. Is the friction and heat an issue? How do you dissipate the heat buildup?
Yeah, so friction is really the main issue, and of course with friction comes heat. Heat is a lesser concern than the friction and the forces that you have on the blades, particularly when they get stuck, so to speak, or we call them stalling when they're in operation. If you have the water forces pushing on the blades and the forces, the internal forces, friction forces in the hub become too much, then you can't move the blades. And that becomes a very dangerous, uncontrolled situation. So that's the biggest concern, less than heat, because the blades don't move as much. You know, they're just twisting a little bit, unlike, you know, an engine where it's spinning around at thousands of RPMs a minute. Mm-hmm. We don't have that same type of heat issues.
So in an air system compared to a liquid system, do you have better control of the friction in either one, or is the same?
They appear to be fairly similar. Okay. They appear to be fairly similar. I got to be careful here. Yeah. I want to make sure I don't want to divulge too.
That's fine. That's just a curiosity question. So yeah. I'm sure we'll be briefed on that at some time.
Right.
Yeah. You will.
That would be good.
So, okay. Great questions, though.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
Commissioners, any other comments, questions?
No. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for our manager items.
Okay. So I think we are now on to commissioner items. And commissioners, we have some motions here. Would someone like to make a proposed motion? Set some meetings?
We could do it all in one motion if we want.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Set three meetings?
Yeah, yes.
You want to do it?
Sure.
Okay.
So I would move to approve the upcoming meetings on February 6th, 17th, and 14th, as so noted.
Okay.
Will that work?
Do we need?
Wait, we're
in different months at different times and at different locations, so you might want to read the whole description.
So February, the motion is for February 6th to meet for general manager annual review, March 17th for the purpose of holding a board workshop, and April 14th for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting.
Do we need to give the location? I think we should throw the locations in there.
Okay. That would be a good idea.
February. Just read it verbatim?
Yeah.
Please.
Well, that's a novel idea. So I move to set the following special meetings on Thursday, February 6th, 2020 at 9 a.m. at the headquarters commission boardroom for the purpose of conducting a general manager annual review on March 17th at 8 a.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a board workshop. And on April 14th, 2020, at 1 p.m. at Confluence Technology Center, 285 Technology Center Way, Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The ayes have it.
And with that, we're up to commission travel. Lisa Sanders.
Well, one other commissioner item that I just, before we got to that, I mentioned this to Steve earlier today, and it's not about PUD, but I just feel like this is a place to mention it. In this morning's Wenatchee World, there's an obituary. And the last name was familiar to me, so I decided to read it. It's a 95-year-old lady from Poland who is a survivor of the Holocaust. And you all should go home and read that obituary. It's just her last name is Sibicki, and it's a powerful, powerful obituary about a life. So that's all I want to say.
Bernie, that was in today's paper?
This morning. I read it this morning. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So we Commissioner Travel?
Commissioner Travel, Lisa.
Afternoon. So our next travel dates start in February. We are in February. It doesn't feel like it. February 12th to 14th in Olympia for Waputa meetings are Commissioners Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith. Do we have any changes to those?
Lisa, I just want to call your attention to I have some family issues going on that might call me away at a moment's notice, and if that's the case, then I would not be going to Olympia.
Okay.
It is my intent to go to Olympia, but we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Okay. I'll let you know.
Yeah. All right. February 24 to 26, we have Commissioners Arsenault and Smith traveling to Washington, D.C. for the APPA legislative rally. Looks like we're all set with those. March 11 to 13, NWPPA Board of Trustees meeting for Commissioner Congdon. March 18 to 20, Waputa meetings. I have Commissioners Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith attending. In April, we have Waputa annual meeting. I haven't seen the location on that yet.
Last time I asked, they still didn't have it nailed. It's probably going to be at Olympia, but they weren't sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, you guys, it is Olympia. I heard from Carol this morning.
Oh, okay.
So it is Olympia.
So would you like
yes.
rooms at your normal locations?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll make those. Do you want to check in the 14th or the 15th?
I would normally still go over on Tuesday evening for me, whatever day.
14th.
Yeah. And I will not be attending.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else, the 14th or 15th?
I'll be going on the 15th.
15th?
Wednesday.
What's the date on that again? That's
April 15 to 17.
I'm not going to that. I'm going to attend the Energy Northwest meeting following week.
Yeah. And I noticed on here, Steve, it says April 22nd for Energy Northwest, but I think it's maybe the 18th. I might want to check that date.
Okay. NWPPA annual meeting May 17 through 20. I have Commissioners Arsenault, Congdon, and McKenna planning to attend in Kennewick.
Yes.
Yes.
And that,
go ahead.
I was just going to, that June, you know, you and I talked about I'm coming back on the 11th, I think. And that is the Wednesday, and the hotel room's a lot more for that that's the keynote breakfast that last day.
Oh, yes. I was able to get you both a single night reservation for the night of the 10th.
Okay. Is it the night of the 10th? The 10th is Wednesday.
The night.
I don't need to stay Wednesday night. I'm looking at June.
So the night of the 9th, I think, to check out the 10th.
Yeah, checking out the 10th.
Yes. Okay. Well, so we have both of those confirmation numbers listed.
Good.
Which gets you checking out on the 10th. And I asked them, I requested you not have to change rooms. So I would ask that you maybe double check and ask that again when you check in for our... Just hopefully get that request fulfilled. Okay. June 25th, we have the Waputo Water meeting.
No, I will not be going.
Thank you. Anyone else?
I'll be attending that.
Thank you.
July, did the July WAPUTA? I have APPA policymakers to add. July 20th through 23rd.
And what is that?
APPA policymakers.
Okay.
And I will not be attending that. I'll go to the Energy Northwest.
On the 29th?
Correct.
So you won't be attending the July 15 to 17?
Yes.
Okay. Anyone else have any changes?
So there's a date, and I'm trying to determine what that date is for the telecom workshop, which will be in Spokane.
Okay.
I can't put my finger on it right now, but I'll give you that date. It'll be May or June. Can't remember the exact date.
Okay.
And I just about forgot. I'm not going to the July WAPUTA meetings either.
Okay.
I'm not either.
Okay, so for July, we just have Commissioner Arsenault and maybe Commissioner Bowles?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And... So you're looking into the telecom meeting, Commissioner Arsenault?
I will, yes.
Okay.
Generally May, I thought.
It was May. I can't think. May or June, and yeah. I can't recall the date.
And it is in Spokane.
It is in Spokane. Yeah. It'll be at the Davenport Hotel. Oh, so you're right, Commissioner Bolts. I found the date. It is May 13 and 14.
And that added?
Yes, and we'll need reservations at the Davenport.
Anyone else attending that? Nope. Okay. So back to July 29th, Commissioner McKenna to Energy Northwest. And then into September back to Waputa meetings. We don't have rooms held there yet. Okay. Anything else?
I think that's good.
There will be more. There'll be another October meeting for me, but I don't know where yet. So.
Okay. We'll when you're ready, just let me know and I'll get it added. Okay.
Thanks, Lisa. Thank you.
Thank All you right. very much.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we already went through the delegation of action items from the previous board meeting, so I'm prepared to jump to the delegation of action items from this meeting. We've got three that identified. First, Tracy will clarify the $5 per policy proposed legislation, Tracy or Sean, and to what insurance policies would be applicable. Sean said he was pretty sure it's property and casualty, but we've checked that just to be sure. Lindsay will provide the kilowatt hour point at which those will experience a less than or more than 3% rate increase. And then I thought we would just check the math on the 1% increase. Just because it was a comment that was made here, we owe it to them to at least test that, whether it was actually 72,000 kilowatt hours would be a 1% increase. So we'll just check on that and get back to you and let you know.
Could you tag something else onto that?
Sure.
Just an item of curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
That if someone were to actually use that much power, what is the dollar amount that that 1% represents?
Sure.
I think it's going to be a big number.
So you want that in
the $1,100 bill?
Annual or monthly? Do you care?
Monthly.
Monthly bill. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. We will do that.
Thank you.
That's it.
Okay. So, public comment? No? So, there's no members of the public want to wish to comment at this time. We will need a small executive session, a short one, for approximately how long?
15 minutes.
Okay, so we will need an executive session to discuss.
We modified this, I think.
I have it right here. Okay. To review the performance of a public employee as authorized by the RCW. So we will go into executive session for 15 minutes. We are coming out of executive session. It is February 3rd, 2020. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we shall stand adjourned.